Hi, this is Ed Long from Information Farm, informationfarm.blogspot.com. Today we have Bob Dobbs, yes, the real Bob Dobbs, who you may know from Achieve Radio's Cash Flow program on Wednesdays with James Martinez, Bob's wife, Dr. Carolyn Dean, and Ion. I first heard of Bob from James Martinez's interview with Project Camelot back in November of 2009, where he talked about his relationship with Walter Bort. Well, today, Bob's going to give his side of the story and tell us about his experiences with Walter Bort. So, Bob, take it away.
Okay, so we're going to go to the Wikipedia, and I'll read the first paragraph. It says, Walter Bort, born May 14, 1939, passed on December 18, 2007. He was an American leader in the counterculture movement of the 1960s, founder and editor of the first underground newspaper in New York City called East Village Other, and author of the book Operation Mind Control. Born in Omaha, Nebraska, Bort was adopted as a newborn by Walter and Fenna Bort. He was raised in Enid, Oklahoma, and won a McMahon Scholarship in Journalism to the University of Oklahoma. In the early 1960s, Bort moved to New York City to pursue his interest in painting, and there he met his first wife, Linda Dugmore, daughter of abstract expressionist Edward Dugmore, and had his first son, Wolf. In 1965, Bort, along with John Wilcock, Sherry Needham, and Alan Katzman, founded the East Village Other. EVO offered a newsprint medium for the rants, artwork, poetry, and comics of such 1960s icons as Tim Leary, Allen Ginsberg, Abby Hoffman, Robert Crumb, Marshall McLuhan, Spain Rodriguez, and the Fugs. In 1966, Bort testified before the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency about banning LSD. He drew national attention with his recommendations. And one last sentence. Through his connection with ex-Harvard professor Tim Leary, Walter met his second wife, Peggy Hitchcock. They moved to Tucson, Arizona in 1968, where Bort founded Omen Press, a publishing house for metaphysical books. Among other books, Omen Press published This is the New Age in Person by Sufi Sam, for which Bort wrote the foreword. Bort and Peggy Hitchcock had two daughters, Sophia and Nuria. Okay, now that's a good summation, a skeleton. Now I want to fill in the details of what I know after I met Walter in 1979. So it begins in the mid-60s. I was all over the place, and I certainly was in New York City a lot. So I started reading the East Village Other pretty soon after it came out in 65. And I was intrigued by the paper and what was going on, but I never went over there to meet anybody. But when Avant Garde magazine published an article on Walter Bort, I think it might have been their inaugural issue, I'm not sure, around 1968, Avant Garde magazine did a whole article on Walter, and that really piqued my interest, and I was determined to meet him someday. It never happened for another 11 years, but once I met him, it certainly was profitable, and this is what I found out about him. He was adopted, and he was an accomplished jock in high school. He was a big, handsome guy, and he was probably a key player on his high school team. And some of his fellow players went on to pro football. I think he knew a couple in the Canadian Football League. I don't know if he finished the University of Oklahoma, because I understand that he went to New York City the late 50s, not the early 60s. And he did start off in journalism, so I'm not sure exactly how many years he did in college in journalism, but that was his profession. But Walter was an artist also, a painter, a writer, a poet. So he was an interesting character with his jock sensibilities and his aesthetic sensibilities. And he also, we know from his diaries now that some of his ex-wives told me about, that he was kind of psychic in his teens and was picking up weird things and ghost spirits or whatever. So he's a pretty potentially well-rounded person, you know, covered the whole range of experience. So the thing that I remember is that he may have dropped out of journalism and he went to New York City to be an artist. I think he got bored with journalism, something like that, though I'm not exactly sure. I know he gets in New York and that's where it begins. And he becomes a bartender at a famous bar called Stanley's. And it was there that he met all the abstract painters, and he probably met his first wife, Linda, through that scene because she was the daughter of an abstract expressionist, you know, the Cedar Tavern world. And I know that he had an interaction with Yoko Ono in 61 or so, 62, either he took over her loft or he gave his loft to her. Don't know which way it went. So he knew Yoko, he knew John Cage, he knew all the people. So he was gravitating towards being an artist at that point and not being a journalist. But in 63, 64, he and his wife and son Wolf dropped out and went to Puerto Rico. And the Avant-Garde article, if you ever look it up in the library, goes into some of the details. And he, like, lived in the jungle, lived with very little anything, and had, you know, Garden of Eden experience and really liked it. But he had read Marshall McLuhan's, I think, Understanding Media in that period. So he was thinking about the McLuhan's ideas while he was in retreat, and he decided that there was so much bad news that he remembered was existing, because I don't know how much news he took up in the jungle, but he decided to come back and create a newspaper around good news, nothing but good news, and sort of create that, I guess, positive vibration. So he had that notion, he came back, and he started East Village Other, and then these other characters joined up with him quickly. But a big influence on Walter was Ishmael Reed in that period. He met Ishmael Reed, the famous black novelist, and became a close friend of Walter, and it was almost like Ishmael Reed created the paper with Walter, in my memory of Walter talking about it, but he's officially not connected to the paper, but he was an important person on Walter, in Walter's life. So that's, and I'll jump ahead. Walter reconnected with Ishmael Reed in the late 80s, early 90s. And Ishmael Reed was a famous author, but a professor. And he said to Walter, you know, I should have been like you, Walter, and gone into the private sector. That was Ishmael Reed's assessment, at least confidentially to Walter. I should have gone into the private sector, not, you know, work in the educational public bureaucracies. So he considered that Walter had gone into the private sector and he hadn't. Okay, so what happened to Walter? So he's doing the East Village Other and he's meeting everybody. He remembers being interviewed by the young Barbara Walters, who was a new broadcaster in New York City, and she came down. It was such a scene the paper was making that even the mainstream news wanted to find out about him. So he remembers interacting with her. And he met everybody else, and he was involved with the Andy Warhol scene. I remember him saying that he wasn't impressed with the Warhol scene. They were all, you know, junkies and that, and he wasn't interested in that kind of drug life. So he testifies in 1966 for the Senate Committee on LSD and all that stuff. And he had that had a big effect on him. And he felt that there were people starting to target him and try to feed him bad drugs. And he was doing LSD in the Leary scene. And he took some drug, don't know what it was. He found out things later and had theories about what it was. But he ended up stoned for about 40 days. And he mastered the universe while doing that trip, you know, in some way. He just, everything came to him, UFOs, I don't know, the whole thing. Could have all been synaptic explosions or sparks, but it was really significant. And so that's in late 66, and then he moves into 67, and he decides he doesn't like being in New York City. It's a hassle doing East Village Other. And he starts looking around. He imagines that Marshall McLuhan had a son. He could have found out, but he never. He just imagined he had a son, and he wanted to find him and start something with Eric McLuhan, because he really was influenced by McLuhan, and that was a big factor in his thinking. And he didn't find out that Eric McLuhan was in New York City working on McLuhan's newsletter for executives called the McLuhan Dewline, DEW-LINE, DEW for Distant Early Warning, the NORAD defense receptors, transmitters up in the Arctic around Canada for the Americans. So the Dewline was what McLuhan punned on for his newsletter, And so he didn't know that Eric was in New York and never connected with him. So in early 68, he had hooked up with Peggy Hitchcock Mellon. She was a Mellon, but she was the Hitchcock part. And they went out to Arizona and stayed in some property in an area called Paradise. And that led to him getting married to Peggy. Okay, so let's go back to the issues that Walter was really involved in. He was interesting and interested in the JFK assassination and things like that, and he got in touch with Mae Brussel eventually. He could think conspiratorially, sort of, or start taking on that way of thinking. So while he's thinking that way and getting paranoid about who was slipping him bad LSD, he was also thinking about the media dynamics as an artist. So here you have, my thesis here is that Walter Bowers created a pattern that all of us go through. It's the Walter Bowers syndrome. And it's juggling the formal effects of media and then with the content, what is said by people on TV. And if you go back and look at some footage of the Duke of Windsor around 1936, film footage, here's this king-to-be, or maybe he's even king at that point for a few months. He's trying to present himself on a film screen, and he has no clue how to do it. He just looks like a bungling idiot, you know. He just doesn't know how to speak. And so you can look at that, showing how people did not know that they looked differently on media than they thought, and they had to think of how to react or how to talk and address that medium when they're in it. That kind of thinking never got clarified till McLuhan. So you have all these crazy media effects that the elites and the average person don't understand. But Walter saw that McLuhan was. So you look at the larger conditioning that the formal effects of media create, as well as the content, verbal, messaging, propaganda that the society's leaders or bureaucrats put out. And the bureaucrats are trying to control people with verbal or written messages, but there are these unforeseen effects on people that the medium itself, regardless of the content, is affecting people. So Walter, and I found this out later when I met him in 1979, since I was working with McLuhan and all that, and I would bring these notions in, I found out that Walter knew this and or was thinking about it, and I had picked that up on his writings, so that's why I wanted to talk to him. But in 1979, the whole decade of the 70s had happened, and Walter had discovered the MK Ultra files in the National Archives, and so he got into the top, what I call the top-down conspiratorial propaganda, population manipulation stuff that MK Ultra represented. Now, he already was thinking that way before, so he's ready to get more information when he discovered the archives in 75, 76, or when he went there. But he's also thinking the formal effects. So you have go back to 1967 with the levitating of the Pentagon, you know, led by people like Abbie Hoffman and that. Well, a little-known part of the story is that Bowert is a publisher of these Village Other. He got the idea of dropping plane loads of flowers over the Pentagon and protesters when that was happening, which would be October 67. So, if I recall, he went, he put an ad in the paper for flowers or for something. So he put feelers out there. So he started getting weird phone calls. So he suspected that the FBI or somebody was monitoring him. So when he went out to get the flowers and the plane at some airport on the day appointed day, he noticed there was no one around. It was totally empty at the hangar or wherever it was. And he just felt that there was people watching him. Now, I can't remember the next details. I know that the flowers ended up in the Pentagon, and you have that famous picture of the girl, the hippie girl, putting a flower in some Pentagon soldier's rifle. You remember that picture, Ed?
Yes, indeed.
Well, Walter used to say those were his flowers, so he somehow got the flowers there, and I can't remember right now how he saw that he was surveilled, and something happened, and he got around it, and he got the plane off, and they dropped the flowers. Now, I may be wrong on the exact precision of that, but To me, it was interesting to find out that the whole flower icon was stimulated by Walter's idea and the suspicious activities around him once he put the idea out in his paper and what happened that tried to frustrate it. Okay, so that's an experience. So here's this guy who's on the information level, is running a newspaper that's affecting New York City, and back then it was a simpler time, and New York was the headquarters, and you don't mess with New York City, and Walter was. So he started to get spied on, but he was cool because he was an artist. So he could think about all kinds of other ways of doing it, not just reacting like a point of view or angry. He'd be creative. So certainly Eastville Jether was creative as in graphic design and all that stuff, and that's Walter's artistic part. Okay, so then he meets Peggy Hitchcock, and he told me later that he became the first yuppie. And they got married about 69, I think, 68, 69, 70. And they end up in Tucson, Arizona, and that's when he went New Agey. He created the Omen Press. Oh, I should say that he gave up the Eastville Jether because he didn't like the way the interpersonal hassles that was happening at the paper and around it. He just didn't want to keep being harassed, because basically Walter was a guy looking for slack, you know, artistic, aesthetic slack, and he wasn't going to take something so seriously that he could lock down in it and become a fanatic about it. If it was causing headaches, not fun anymore, he'd leave. So he finds himself in Arizona, he starts his press, and he meets Sufi Sam. He talked about Sufi Sam to me a lot, and he was impressed with the guy and promoted him and wrote his book. But in 68, 69, it would have to be before Nixon was elected in the fall of 68. He always had this story, and any close friends he would tell the story. He was hanging out with the Mellons, going to their family reunions. It's huge. I was once in Peggy's house and saw a picture of one of these reunions. It's like 1,000 people, like many families, many relatives all come together. It's probably about 150, 200 people, but it looks pretty impressive. And so he was at one of these reunions, being introduced to the Mellon relatives in 68. And somebody like the family accountant or one of the accountants or the family lawyer said to him, this is what he said, "We're going to put Nixon in office, we're going to create a depression and make it a privilege to have a job." Now, I don't know if they knew who Walter was, don't know why they told him, but he heard that said to him. And that just think of that, you know, you're right there among the so-called elite of America and you hear that statement. You're already prone to be suspicious of people or of the elites. I mean, you can't say Walter was a communist or an anarchist. He did, the first issue of the Eastville Jether featured Alfred Jarry's pataphysics design, so he was a pataphysician, which led into a yippie sensibility, and he was at the founding of the yippies. So you have this interesting creative mind hearing the quote Illuminati say what they're going to do, right? And he was pretty cynical or whatever, aware, but he never, you know, that was an important impression on him, and he always talked about it to close friends. Like, so he saw it, he saw the effect of Nixon before Nixon got in, he heard about what they were going to do, so it didn't surprise him. And that may be partly why, I can't say he said this or thought it, but it might be why he retreated from New York and went to the country, and the happy scene of Tucson, Arizona. Okay, so what happens now? There's that's an important anecdote. And then he's mingling with the lifestyle that Peggy Hitchcock could provide. And so he said, in retrospect, he was the first yuppie. He was a hippie who became a yippie. He was a beatnik in the 50s, became a hippie, and then a yippie, and then a yuppie. And it was only because in 73, 74... that it says in the book Operation Mind Control, a family friend or someone, a young soldier, came around to him and started explaining about his memory losses. And if you read Operation Mind Control, that intrigued Walter, and he started looking into it, and that led him to the National Archives. And he was the first to, you know, talk about those issues, the MKUltra program, in popular press. The person who was a bit ahead of Walter was the Lyndon LaRouche organization. They started suspecting, and you can look at their Campaigner magazine, they started looking into the idea of MKUltra and using drugs to hypnotize people in 73-74. And my friend Mark Stallman in New York City, he was a member of the LaRouche organization, and he was a bodyguard, but LaRouche, or the team there, sent him to the National Archives, and he was looking into the same documents as Walter Borat, probably just after Walter Borat, but went through it, and that produced the book Dope Inc. So the part about MKUltra and the Grateful Dead were part of MKUltra and Ken Kesey and the Palo Alto LSD experiments, all that idea was created by Mark Stallman. He developed that idea when looking at it in the archives and then gave it to LaRouche, and they put in Dope Inc. And that's always been a controversial point for the counterculture because, you know, they like LSD and they thought it was great, and a big chunk of them anyways, and they didn't know why LaRouche was against that or would be suspicious of Jerry Garcia. I mean, that's blasphemy, right?
Exactly.
So, but Walter, here's Walter who, I mean, Peggy, here's a side thing about Peggy. In May 1999, I was going out to see Walter in Tucson, Arizona, and I asked Peggy if I could interview her, because she's had such an interesting life. I mean, you can look in Flashbacks, the book by Tim Leary, and there you see Peggy with Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and maybe Leary, 1963, the period of Millbrook. And she's the one providing that whole scene. She gets that, her and her brothers get that going. And that's just one thing that Peggy's been involved in. So I asked her if I could interview her, and she says, okay, come out and stay in the guest cottage, and over a week or two, we'll do an hour or so every day. So I did a long interview, it was about 13 and a half hours, went through her whole life, which is an amazing story, and she wanted it, she accepted it on the principle that mothers don't write letters to their daughters anymore like she did when she grew up in the 30s. And so she didn't felt that her daughters knew about her life, and so she wanted to leave an audio recording for them, you know, about her life, about details they may not have known about. And so that's why we were doing it. I wasn't doing it for putting on the radio or anything. It was a private thing, and I wanted to get it on record. And so I spent a lot of time with Walter in between while with Peggy. So one of the things Peggy told me she did was, when the Grateful Dead made their first album, they had budget problems, and she provided some money to get that first album out. So she's key in the whole Grateful Dead scenario. So one of the things that Peggy did in her life was she helped Grateful Dead get out their first album. She gave them some extra money. They were starving and wasn't looking good for the album, and she helped get the Grateful Dead myth started, you know. She's there. So there's Walter involved with Grateful Dead, and here's LaRouche saying the Grateful Dead is an MKUltra scenario, and Walter's in between. He's not, you know, fooled by hippie naivety. He's sophisticated. He's a journalist, and his East Village Other is mentioned in the history of journalism. You know, any books on the history of 50s and 60s, what he did is part of journalism history that students learn. So he's not naive. He understands that it could be a subtle ruse, considering what he heard from that lawyer in the Mellon Enclave. And let's put it on the record. I don't know if the rest of the Mellons knew this, but this one guy said it, you know, whoever he was, and he was planning to do this, and maybe he pulled it off, and the Mellons didn't even know, right?
Right.
So. Or the Hitchcocks didn't even know. So here's Walter. He's the first to popularize the MKUltra situation. Only people in New York City really knew about LaRouche stuff and would read his newspaper on the streets, and they probably thought it was a bunch of nutty stuff anyways. But LaRouche was onto it, and Mark and his associates did some interesting stuff in the book Dope Incorporated, which came out in 78, just after Walter's book Operation Mind Control, which I think came out late 77, early 78. Okay, so Walter gets involved in this, and this is where I meet him. I'm at the McLuhan Center, end of November 1979. Now, Marshall McLuhan has had a stroke on September 26, 1979, and he couldn't be attend his weekly public seminars in the Center for Culture and Technology on the University of Toronto campus. This center has been going since 1963. So his son, Eric, carried on the seminars through October, November. Now remember, it was the last week in November. These people came into the seminar, I'd never seen before, and they handed out leaflets. And on them they said that Walter Boert was coming to Toronto to speak within a week or so about Operation Mind Control. I go, wow. I had read the book, I had seen it. And I find out that they're a Church of Scientology people. And they grabbed onto his book because they were so anti-psychiatry. Here was a guy who gave a whole bunch of research to make you paranoid about psychiatry. So they were supporting him, and they funded his tour all over the place. So he was coming, he was going to be speaking in Toronto on like December 2nd, I think, 1979, on a Sunday. And I went to that, and I went in there, and before the speech started, I saw him standing in the hallway, went up and introduced myself, and we talked, and he said, oh, we should talk. I said some things, and he knew that would be interesting, so he said, let's talk after. So after the lecture, which was really good, great slideshow and everything, we got together, and we started talking in his hotel room, and we hung out for a week. And we had, so the first Sunday night, we're talking, and he finds out that I'm very involved with McLuhan, and he is really excited about that. And he says, I'd love to meet McLuhan. I said, well, he just conked out, you know, a few months ago, September. He's got aphasia. He can't speak or talk or write or anything. But his son is having seminars. Why don't you come tomorrow night, Monday night? He said, sure. So I brought him in, and I introduced him to Eric, and I said, Walter's an author. Maybe he could speak after the main guest. And Eric said, okay. So it turned out this was going to be the last meeting of the McLuhan Center. We didn't know at the time, but what happened was Eric gave a talk on his book about subliminal seduction, the Wilson Brian Key stuff. You know that book, Subliminal Seduction, about sex images and letters put in advertising? You ever heard of that theme, Ed?
I have heard of the theme.
Yeah, Subliminal Seduction, Wilson Key, something like that, K-E-Y. The foreword to that book about 1973 was written by McLuhan, so McLuhan was a friend of Key, and so Eric knew the stuff. So he did a lecture on that stuff, basically what was in the book Subliminal Seduction, with some newer ads and just showing the subliminals put in the design of the images, sexual images, pornographic or obscene images, so-called. And so he did that, and he went on and on and on, and someone in the audience said, hey, Eric, we got it. We understand. Let's hear from this other guy that Bob brought in. Right? It sounds interesting. I probably whispered about who Walter was. And so Eric said, okay. So we bring up Walter, and he gives the history of his involvement researching MKUltra, and it's a kind of topic that was never discussed in the Center for Culture and Technology, not publicly. McLuhan was aware of that kind of stuff, and you could get it out of him privately, but not publicly. So it was a unique theme for everybody, the usual regulars there, and they hadn't heard that kind of information. And in retrospect, it was really interesting that Walter became the last speaker because the center was closed down within 6 months, and they never continued. Eric didn't continue the seminars after the Christmas holiday into January. That was the last one, December 3rd, 79. So I always thought it was pretty interesting that Boert was the last guy, because here is someone who wanted to work with Eric. He imagined McLuhan had a son, and this is back, you know, when you didn't have the internet and couldn't find out anything about anybody, and you just had telephones or something. So he didn't know Eric was in New York, and here he is 11 years later with Eric and following Eric's analysis based on formal properties in media, the imagery in that, and then it's complemented by Walter talking about top-down bureaucratic CIA manipulation of populations. So it was an interesting yin-yang there. And my point of telling you all this is the dialectic that was always in Walter's thinking. He could have been Eric as much as he was Walter. He could do both levels. He didn't have a real, you know, expert awareness of McLuhan. He just got the general stuff that most people got when they read McLuhan. But once we got talking, I was able to refine his understanding of McLuhan and bring in the top-down stuff since I was part of the intelligence world myself. So it became a really creative dialogue. So in April 1980, we were flying to California, Carol and I, so Walter invited us to come to his mansion in Aspen, Colorado, where he was living. And so we stayed there a week or so, and that's where Walter played me the tape. You know the famous part in Operation Mind Control where he meets with the assassin and in a restaurant and all that? Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
Portrait of an assassin. The guy, you know, tells Walter he programs zombies, you know, at the embassy who could shoot people or something. You know, all this programmed scenario, and this guy was part of it. Walter let me listen to that. You know, it was pretty interesting. Walter, he's risking his life there. He's got a microphone hidden in his jacket, and you can hear the clashing of dishes in the restaurant and hear this guy talking in a low voice, just sort of mumbling along, sort of not sure what to tell Walter. He probably was checking out Walter himself. You know, they only agreed to meet him because Walter had put the book out, Operation Mind Control, the year before. No, sorry, I got that wrong. The interview was before, and he gets put in the book, and the guy stayed in touch with Walter. He just kept checking Walter out, you know, kept in touch. So in retrospect, he probably agreed to the interview because he wanted to monitor Walter because they knew he was going to do this book. Because it turned out that Dell published the book, and Walter always pointed out that the two head executives of Dell Publishing were CIA guys or ex-CIA or something. So it was pretty interesting. He showed me all his files. It's pretty amazing. He had a huge library. And that house... we jump forward to September 1990, where Carol and I and I think Jerry Fialka was there, the guy who worked for Zappa, we went to the cottage in the wilderness of Paradise, never remember, it's New Mexico or Arizona, it's right in the mixture there, and we come back and we go, Walter wants to introduce us to Peggy. So we go to Peggy, and we meet her, and then we go to dinner, and this is September, so it's a month after August 2nd, 1990, when Hussein went into Kuwait, all right? And she's telling Walter, you know our old home in Aspen? Yeah. Well, that's where the press conference was held. What press conference? Because Walter was out in the boondocks. He wasn't following the media. Well, the day after... August 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, in that period, I think it's Thatcher meets with Bush or the Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State, and they have a press conference on the steps of that home. And so Peggy said it was funny watching the news and watching this big war scenario being created out of Walter and Peggy's former place, which I was in 1980. So I remember that little detail about that place. So... Okay, back to Walter he's doing tours for the Scientologists, and he said that he went through the process and cleared or something, and they part of their payment was, hey, we'll let you go through the e-meter thing. And he found it pretty interesting. He didn't join the cult or anything, but Walter had explored so much that he could go into strange areas or new things, put them on, do them, and learn from them, but not get fanatic about it. So he found it, the e-meter thing, pretty interesting, and he would talk about what he learned from that occasionally. So he was investigating the Scientologists while they were promoting his tour. Okay, so while he's on tour, I don't know if this is confidential, but things happen back at home, and he realizes that the CIA are screwing up his domestic situation. So that led to problems. And so when I went out to his home in 1980, now this is interesting in light of James Martinez's interview. I met James Martinez in about 2002, and I'll get to that. He says to me, you know, Bob, this is after we're spending time and he's comfortable with me. He says, you know, Bob, I really wish I had not written that book. I wish I had gone into fiction. So isn't it interesting that Ismail Reed said, you know, he writes fiction and he's unsatisfied because he should have gone to the private sector as opposed to being a teacher. And Walter's in the in the private sector, but he's known as a journalist, and he does this book, this great book, Operation Mind Control, but he thinks I should have done it in fiction. Because he's looking back, nobody knows this, over the last 2 years, from, you know, 78 to 80, and there's a lot of crap happened because of what he did. And he's also aware enough to realize, what the heck, what does it lead to? Where does it go? I'm an artist. Why do I need this hassle? But so that dilemma, that regret or that yearning is a characteristic of the rest of his life, which James Martinez was talking about. Do you remember James's interview? Do you remember?
Oh, definitely, yes.
So you can see, I'm giving you the background. So James didn't know Walter in the 70s and 80s. He certainly heard a lot about that period because Walter talked about his life a lot. And, you know, it was very interesting stuff, the way he would talk about it. He's always, like, studying the effects on himself of all that he did. And so James picked up the later aspects of it, and in the interview I've listened to it, and he talks about this dilemma, Walter. Well, I'm trying to give aspects of where it came from, and it came from a pretty great intelligence. But the other aspect was because, another aspect was he was an orphan. I don't know if James goes into that. And he would identify with other orphans and team up with them. I mean, he had an issue about being an orphan and feeling alone or something, not loved or something like that, whatever the dilemma is. So here I am. I'm surprised that and intrigued that Walter tells me in April 1980 that he would rather write fiction. And me being in intelligence and knowing the fraud or the importance, take it either way, fraud or importance of propaganda and that dilemma, I thought it was pretty interesting that he understood that what he revealed in an information society where there's so much information no one knows what's true anymore, even by the late 70s, you know, cable TV's come in, that it was silly to make a point journalistically because it didn't matter. Nobody cared and you'd just be fodder for the media and then they go on to some other stuff and then someone else. See, what happened in 79 is John Marx put out the book In Search of the Manchurian Candidate, and Walter always felt that that was put out to cancel the effect of his book. And I just checked it before this interview, and they say, you know, some standard statement, but it's a very bland, out-of-date book. But it's the one that did better than Walter's at the time. But where we are today and how much we know and Freedom Information Files, Walter's is better, and it was so strong, but extreme for most people, that they had to be countered with John Marx's book. And I don't know if Marx was paid by the CIA or somebody, but Walter certainly thought it was a joke book and a lousy book and put out there to counter him. So here he is, he puts out a book, it gets countered, and it makes him happily cynical, I'll say. Happily cynical, because he had a perverse sense of humor. So then he moves to Port Townsend, and I visit him there in 82 and 83. That's in Washington State, and he starts a local newsletter there. Then he gets to Palm Springs, late 80s, and he becomes editor of Palm Springs magazine, whatever it is. Is it Palm Springs in California?
Yes.
Yeah, Palm Springs. And in Townsend, in the Port Townsend newspaper, he's an, you know, country bumpkin guy. It's a fringe thing. He's out in the boondocks. He's nowheres, but he's providing a useful journalistic function locally. I actually have copies. He gave me a whole bunch of copies of that letter. But here he is, 6 years later, he is back in yuppie land again. He's at the top of Palm Springs Society because of the magazine, and you see pictures of him with his great suits and with all these wealthy people. He's part of the social network. He's an important guy because, you know, he's running the local media, right? He's the editor. In that period, he was in Las Vegas or somewhere, someplace, and, yeah, must have been Las Vegas, a gambling place, and he sees John Lennon sitting at the bar. And this is one of his major regrets in his life. He sees John Lennon, and he knows Yoko, so he can go over to John Lennon and bring that up. But he decides that, oh, I'll just leave him alone. I'm not going to hassle him. He's trying to be alone here, be by himself or whatever. So he never went over to talk to him. And that was a big regret subsequent to what happened, right? 1980 when he's shot. I mean, Walter really thought he should have gone and talked to him, because Lenin, whether he knew it or not, was influenced by Bowerd. Lenin funded Paul Krasner's edition of The Realist in 1972, late 72, the May Brussels article that exposes MKUltra, pre-MKUltra stuff. She was onto that stuff early. And what was the behind the scenes of Watergate? It's a famous article, and Yoko and John Lennon gave Paul Krasner $5,000 to publish it, because the regular publisher for The Realist wouldn't do it. It was too controversial. Well, that was the world of Walter Bowerd. He certainly knew May and Krasner and all that, part of that scene. So it would have been an interesting conversation between John Lennon and Bowerd. So it didn't happen, and that was that. So that was part of his life in the yuppie world in the 80s. No, wait a minute. I got that wrong. Lennon died in 1980. So it would have been his Aspen life. Sorry. His Aspen life is when he saw Lennon at the in Las Vegas or someplace. Maybe it was even a casino in Aspen. I don't know. Walter also had some conversations with Jack Nicholson in Aspen. He met Dennis Hopper and Nicholson and Peter Fonda at separate times. And so it's interesting what he says about that. I can't remember exactly the pattern, each one individually. Anyways, so that's in the 70s. So I'm talking about in Palm Springs in the late 80s. I don't know why he left. He may have dropped out again, but by 1989, he's back in Paradise, New Mexico, Arizona, wherever it is. So here he is doing the, you know, he's in the swing of things on the yuppie level in late 80s. Then he drops out, and then Bill Cooper shows up. Remember that book, The Pale Horse? That start, 88-89, that's when sightings started doing specials on UFOs in the early 90s. Here was this whole world that James talks a bit about, the interest in UFOs. He told us he saw a UFO. He probably saw someone on his ass trip in the fall of 66, the 40-day trip. He was interested always in that kind of stuff, and so now it's becoming in the popular media. And then this extreme stuff like abductees and all that starts coming out. So Walter, ever the journalist part of himself, starts to look into this, because this is a new dimension to the MKUltra idea, that people are being programmed to claim to be UFO abductees or not, who knows, you know, all that stuff. And so I was in New York, and he came to Toronto in 91. And he showed me the fiction he was writing on his computer called The Other Crusades. And he was telling me about the new weird world of UFO abductees and what was happening. It's like coast to coast before coast to coast. You know what I mean? That world? You aware of that period in the 80s and 90s?
Yes.
Where people like, was it Lear? He knew somebody. I can't remember these names. These people in the 80s who started putting out information about Dulles, New Mexico, under Area 51 and stuff like that. One of the major sources or spreaders of those ideas was the Cosmic Awareness publications channeled through the third medium for Cosmic Awareness, Paul Shockley. I was getting that newsletter, and they were always on the leading edge of talking about those characters that came around. Lear, you know the guy Lear? Son of the Lear jet
John
person?
Lear, yes.
The what?
John Lear.
Yeah, and he was promoting some guy who had worked at Area 51. I think they were the first to bring out that kind of information. So Walter was always intrigued in the latest paranoid scenarios. So he, in 91, he told me that he was starting to go to these conferences. And then I was in New York in 94, and he visited, and he was doing more of that and doing research and meeting psychiatrists. And that stuff, I guess, is in the second mind control book. You ever seen the second one that he put out? He self-published.
No, this is the revised edition.
Yeah, the revised edition, I guess. And so he was working on that.
That's curious, you know. Since he had this idea of writing fiction, then why did he continue to revise Operation Mind Control, I wonder?
Okay, that's a great question, because I'm trying to get to the problems that I would see, and I still see for all of us, And Walter acted this out. Walter went through it. He was the canary in the mine. He didn't know it, but he was confronting all these questions, like, why do fiction, in a world where all information is reduced to fiction, why do journalism? That was always what he was doing. So he would do all of it. He would keep writing fiction, and because Operation Mind Control, the book became very successful as a standard text, a background text to get people thinking the way into the kind of stuff you present on your site, right? It really is the book that, you know, breaks people's naivety, their rigidity in this way of thinking, because it's well written and lots of interesting documentation, and it's a great book. So he had to live with the image of that and the responsibility of being invited to speak about it. He didn't do much, but he would occasionally go and speak, all from the position of 1980, 2 years after the book came out, that he said, I regret I wrote that. I should have put it in fiction point. But see, he didn't stay within that position. He knew as a crusading journalist, he'd go forward and do the whatever new stuff was happening. So he had what I call quadriphenia, which we all have. We multitask, we're metaphysically promiscuous, we have to deal with so many different areas of information that if you actually look at what we say to different people, you look like you're a hypocrite, you're lying. But you say different things to different levels of society because our speeded up society has you confronting every level immediately, all the time. Okay? So I call that quadriphenia, not schizophrenia. And it's not a bad condition, it's just that we are essentially double. We have a doubleness in us, and we're all cultures try to resolve that. And, you know, as Ion says, two conversations. But now we have an information society that mirrors back that, since the Reagan era, mirrors back that very schizophrenia. You know, places like Crossfire, just both points of view are smashed at everybody immediately, constantly, and cancel each other out. So I say the information environment is schizophrenic. It goes inside us. So our doubleness and the doubleness of the information environment makes two doubleness. That's quadro. That's four. All right? So you look at Walter's career. He's writing fiction. He's doing journalism. He's hiding out. He doesn't want to be famous. He doesn't want that stupid adulation. He does want to do research. He's interested in psychic stuff. He's all over the map. Everything. Doing everything. And at the same time, being harassed by the authorities. He's always there. It's so many times he tried to get a book published and the publisher would be interested, and then it wouldn't be published because they were instructed not to do it. I mean, he was blackballed. Now,
he's still married to Peggy during this time.
Oh, no. The marriage of Peggy broke up during the Operation Mind Control period in the late 70s. He meets Margot when I visit him in 1980, he was with Margot in Aspen. I don't know if they got married, but they're together for a few years. Yeah, I think they got married, yeah. And then Margot went off, influenced by Carolyn. When she met Carolyn, Carolyn did acupuncture on her, and she was amazed. She was a secretary in New Jersey or something. And she went off and learned acupuncture and started working at Canyon Ranch, I think, later. So she left Walter to do her own healing thing under the seduction of Carolyn. And that's my wife, Carolyn Dean. No, that's my bride. I have a new way of talking about this now. She's not my wife. She's not my partner. She's my bride. So Margot and Walter split, and then Walter met Becky, and she was part of his life in Palm Springs. So all the wives know each other. They're all friends. And Peggy was always in touch with Walter because of their daughters. So Walter, you know, under these harassment conditions, remember, this is in the 80s, the Reagan period. A lot of the counterculture is the ideals in that. They're deflated in the 70s. By the 80s, they're just, everybody's going born again Christian or something. They're just depressed, right? They're can't handle what Reagan is doing to America, at least how the TV presents it. And so Walter, in that paranoid scenario, he was wondering what was happening to him. Now, I don't know how much of it was real, and I certainly wasn't doing it to him. Maybe colleagues of mine that I didn't know about were, but the thing is that Walter had a cheery sense of the absurd and sense of humor. He always was a great schmoozer, talker, charmer. He presented himself as a very happy person. People didn't know that he had these private conflicts going on. which James goes into a bit. So in 91, he visited me in Toronto in June or so, and he had his new partner, Pat, who was interested in film and studying film. And then Pat was still with them when they came to us in New York in 94. And then they split, and then Walter is, oh yeah, Walter went, in 94, he, and I don't know if this is confidential, but I'm going to say it anyways, in 94, he left me in New York, and he went back to Tucson. No, he went back to his property in Paradise, and he calls me pretty quickly, and he says, I've been busted. While he was away, he found this out. While he was away, some neighbor who hated him, knew about him, or maybe was prompted by others, planted some marijuana on his property. So when he came back, the cops were ready, and they busted him. So I don't know what happened to trial or something, but he ended up on probation for about 3 years. And he couldn't leave Tucson. He couldn't leave Arizona or New Mexico. No, he was in Tucson. So I guess it's, I can't remember, but let's say Paradise is in Arizona. Whatever it is, he had to stay in Tucson, but the bust happened in the Paradise area. So he was stuck there, and so that's why I visited him in 99 in Tucson. So he was under wraps, and he was depressed and limited, and he was trying to get out his second edition then. He was using the internet, and you'd like order it, and he'd publish it for you or something, you know, print it off, that kind of stuff. And he also was getting ill. He had an ulcer problem or something back in 91. So James Martinez met him in this period. He met him through a TV show in Tucson, I think. And so they started to talk. And eventually, Walter, when he finished his parole and could leave, he went to Los Angeles to stay with James and work on getting Operation Mind Control published. I mean, made into a movie. So he's in Santa Monica. Santa Monica, Venice area, Marina Del Rey, Santa Monica, from like 99, 2000 to a few months before he died. Now here's what's interesting. He's there, he's meeting with Oliver Stone, as James talked about, and he's very frustrated because he's got certain ideals about how this stuff should be made in a movie, but nobody gets it, and he can't handle the marketing and the superficiality of Hollywood, so he's always in a bad mood about that, and not impressing people in the normal protocols of how you get a project going. So he's on edge, and then 9-1-1 happens, and I don't know if James told the story. Did he tell you what happened in 9-1-1? No, he didn't. I don't think he did. They see it happening in their apartment, and quickly Walter goes into his own room, locks the door, and here's all this drama going on. James is watching it by himself, and Walter's locked himself away. So about 45 minutes to an hour later, James knocks on the door and goes into Walter's room, and Walter's there, and James does not know these two names that he's going to hear. He doesn't know who they are, but Walter says to him, Bob and McLuhan are right. They're goddamn geniuses. They're right. James is looking at him, thinks he's nuts. Who's Bob and who's McLuhan, right? And he's saying, he's not responding about 911 in a normal way or whatever one would do. He's saying, Bob and McLuhan were right or are right. And they're geniuses. Okay, so I don't know this is happening. And the next day, okay, I find out about this about 6 months later. James calls me up out of the blue when I was living in New York City. And so here's what he tells me. He says, Walter says, Bob and McLuhan are right, blah, blah, blah. And so James says, well, who are you talking about? So Walter begins to tell him about me and McLuhan, which he really hadn't said much to James about. They were too involved in just getting the movie off the ground. And I don't know how much James was aware of the mind control stuff. He probably read the book. He knew of some of it in his own experience. And So over the next few months, he hears Walter fills him in on what he's thinking. And then James phones me out of the blue in the spring of 2002 to tell me that he's a friend of Walter, and Walter was talking about me, and he wanted to know who I was, blah, blah, blah. So in the course of that phone call, James is starts, when he hears a bit about this media effects and that kind of stuff, he starts telling me about the effects of the cell phone in Hollywood, because he works in Hollywood in the movie scene. I think he was a cast director or something, so he was in touch with the social life of Hollywood, and he was talking to me about the disastrous effects of the cell phone on social life. And that's right up my alley. And so I was able to talk about it pretty instantly. He was feeding me new data that I could make patterns out of. And if you listen to Cashflow before Ion shows up, we never stopped that conversation. That's what the Cashflows were about. James talked about what was going on in L.A., and I'd come on and give some patterns about it. So, but he told me, eventually told me in that spring call about how Walter said we were geniuses. And I kind of intuited what it meant and laughed. But he goes into the details, and here was the extra part. He said the next day, after 911, within a day or so, after saying we're geniuses, he said, Bob's an idiot. Bob's a, what an idiot. And he'd go on complaining about me. And James just couldn't figure out what the heck's going on. One day he's praising Bob McClellan, the next day he's saying they're idiots. Okay? So this is hilarious to me when I hear it, because I know exactly what Walter's going through, because we discussed it many times. So we come back to the point. You have the top-down control of society, and you have the bottom-up, which is just the media effects that the top-down guys can only play catch-up to. And if we're looking at what is power and who runs who, you have to use the bottom-up, especially the McLuhan advanced knowledge, and the secret knowledge of May Brussel, Executive Intelligence Review, and Sherman Skolnik, and all those great investigators of the 60s and 70s. That now is common stuff on websites all over the place. But the websites don't know the McLuhan angle. And Walter Bower did, and he always included it in his thinking. And he did a couple of interviews on a TV show in Arizona with Ted Lohman called UFO AZ, I think it was. It was a public access, very good show all through the 90s that interviewed everybody that would eventually be on Art Bell or Coast to Coast. I mean, Ted and them were on the leading edge of that stuff. And I would watch it on New York cable. And he interviewed Walter several times. And if you look at those interviews, if you ever could get access to them, here's Walter doing the top-down stuff. And he always did this. About two-thirds of the way through the interview, after he just stunning people with his data on the top-down conspiratorial control and the MKUltra stuff, he'd flip into bottom-up analysis. He'd always confuse the interviewer, like he'd say, well, that's nothing compared to what McLuhan's talking about. And then he would try to explain that. So the juggling of the top-down and bottom-up was ongoing, and I admired Walter because he was the only guy of the famous counterculture world that really looked into McLuhan, got a good handle on it, then had the advantage of learning a lot from me, because I'm one of the most knowledgeable people about McLuhan in the world, just because I knew McLuhan for so long and read all the stuff. So Walter learned a lot from me on that, so he could use that through the 80s and 90s, whereas all the other guys, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tim Leary, whoever, remember Leary got into McLuhan in his final years, but anyways, here's Walter already thinking about all this stuff and being detached in relation to both the top-down and the bottom-up. So you get, because he was aware of that, you'd get very interesting conversations between me and him. And fortunately, a couple are taped. They're not perfect, but at least they show us interacting. But this is the thing, Ed. This relates to what you're doing. You're putting out a lot of top-down information, like Alex Jones or anybody else, and they don't go into what I call the Android meme, which is technology coming alive and taking on a life of its own and replaying the effects that technology did on us for the last 2,000 years, which McLuhan laid out in his books. So what is mind control? What is a mind and what's being controlled? All of this has just been a preamble to our discussion, all right? The issues that I'm interested in and Bowert was interested in, and it's never come out, other than the obituary I wrote for Walter, about this aspect of Walter's depth of thinking. He's an important thinker. And he suffered with that awareness, also was cool enough to have a good time at the same time, but he was a great early example of quadrophenia. So Ed, tell me what you mean by MKUltra and what you think it is in mind control, then I figure out what you mean and then I'll respond. Just take mind control. What is mind control happening in our society?
Definitely.
Where do you see evidence of that?
See evidence of that from the first steps we take from our parents, from the first TV shows that we see, and from the education that we get when we go to school.
Is that bad?
Well, I don't know if it is or not, but you're just...
All right, hold that question. That's a good point. I don't know if it is or not, right? We don't know at this point. We know so much that we are even detached about that issue. Whereas, you know, at the time of George Orwell and the literate people of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, to have someone to influence your thinking was obscene, was outrageous. All right? You see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Now, people, because, you know, book information is slower and it's methodical and you read it linearly across the page and you assess the argument, you form an opinion about it. And then someone else reads another book, and then you might hear about that, and you might write a letter to them, and you might argue about what that book said. Okay, just think of that in the 19th century. Then think of your life. You're processing the points of view 24/7 all over the place, even if you weren't on a website. You know what I mean? Because you're surrounded by information, electrified information everywhere. So, and then when radio comes in, you don't have to read a book. You can hear it. You can hear it right away. Then TV, you come in, and you can hear it and see it. And then cable, you can see even more. And then when you get the internet, you can edit your own stuff and make your own information. Do you see that as that unfolded the last 100 years, having an opinion would wither. It wouldn't be important. You're just engaging. You just have insights and patterns which would quickly be contradicted or inspired by some other opposite view. You getting my point about the turnover of information we process compared to 100 years ago? You've heard of the cliche that newspapers were wilder in the 19th century. There were many more of them and very long prose written articles, you know. Just think, it's totally different how they thought and how they interacted and formed an opinion about what was going on or a sense of social consensus. You can see that, as McClune predicted, the electric environment allows everybody to hear something at the same time, but you can turn it off and on at your will and come in and out at different times. So instead of when you read a book, you generally read the same book, though your personal projections into it would be subjective and different, but in general, you're reading the same book and having the same experience. You're not having the same experience once radio comes in and then TV and then all this many cables. Everybody's processing things at different rates and not even noticing half of the other stuff being broadcast. So there's no uniformity. So the consensus collapses. And you can see that in the Reagan era, the old-fashioned image of Reagan was a necessary image of social stability, that things are not changing that fast, folks. We still have small-town values. That's the whole image of Reagan in the 80s. Well, in actual fact, everybody's getting fragmented all over the place. And then think of technology as an interview of us and a satire of us. So the internet is fragmenting people even more and connecting people in many diverse ways. So who are you, what culture are you in, since culture was formed by literature or speech, and then you have modern media which creates temporary fad culture, and then that gets fragmented where people make their own culture with their own MySpaces. Where is a point of view in that? And this was McLuhan's point, and this was Wyndham Lewis's point, and it was James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake point. I mean, Finnegan's Wake is the prophetic prediction of the state of mind we're in. It's the map of quadrophenia. And so here's Walter, smart enough, tuned in enough by the early 80s, beginning to see the fragmentation of information. He had an important message with Operation Mind Control, but what the heck? It didn't matter. It gets canceled pretty quickly. I might as well just have written fiction and not have suffered all this private harassment that it disrupted his domestic life. So you see what I mean? And so here you are, you're putting out all this information, and it doesn't matter Okay, when I get up in the morning and I start walking around and using my senses, I don't care what the content of it is too much, I'm just enjoying my senses. We have to look at the media, electric media, as extensions of our senses, and we're enjoying them, and we're looking for new images and synaptic, you know, discharging by new imagery and new sounds when we go on the internet. We're not stopping the flow. So there's no position of acquiring a definite perspective, and we now know this. That's increasingly impossible. So information is not being consumed the way people did 100 years ago. They read a book to get a message to apply it. We do it to swim in it. And then that allows anybody to come up with anything, since we want new images, new simulation. The more bizarre the theory, the more extreme the scenario, it'll be looked into. And that's why, you know, major media, the ratings are going down, nobody's watching, and people are watching sites like yours because you get new bizarre information, new bizarre temporary imagery that if you ask your regular readers of your website, what do they know about this and that? They might have some opinions, but if they're honest, they would say, I don't know nothing. I don't know. There's just too much to know. And you've even said to me yourself, Ed, that you can't know. So you can't even decide whether being conditioned that Orwell worried about is a problem or not, because we have to look at, when I turn on the internet, am I being conditioned? No, I'm enjoying one of my sensory extensions. But then a lot of our society is built on literate values and bureaucratic organization, where it is important whether you're insane or not for doing your job. So that is one aspect, holdover from the industrial culture, that still lingers. And people still have to do that. So you have people, it started with the East Village Other. People had regular straight jobs in New York City, and then they'd go read as a private vice, read the East Village Other, something different from the New York Times. Well, that's been hyped up a billion times with what people do. Well, you know, people work, they're at work now listening to your stuff. You know, they're at work writing, maybe laying a copy, a layout for Time, they work at Time Magazine, or they work at some mainstream, you know, CBS News, and they're taping Dan Rather or whoever the new guy is. What's her name? The latest, Curtis?
Well, you're asking the wrong person.
Yeah, we don't know. We can't even remember what mainstream media has.
They'll be listening to you now. So.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is, the people who work at these mainstream media outlets that are agents of the Illuminati and the establishment and keeping everybody suppressed and not telling the truth, the very employees in between breaks are on their iPod listening to Bob Dean talk about UFOs or Bill Deagle talk about, you know, the Anunnaki or something. and they're listening to me talk nonsense. So look at that. What's going on there? It doesn't matter what's being broadcast on your site, as long as it's different and unique. And that's what they want, what I call their chip body, that part of their body that engages the iPod and the computer. They want new content to be stimulated. They want new weather. They want new senses. New data for their senses. And so they'll be bored at a slow production of a TV show, which is just basic cliches. So they need the stimulation through their chip body of alternative stuff. And it has to be different. And so you have this, you know, growth of internet sites and decentralized, not controlled information outlets with incredible scenarios, incredible to people 30 years ago, which is normal now, but it's not really the points of view or scenarios that Chris Story lays out or anybody else. It's just, hey, this is a different pattern, a different bunch of word arrangement that makes me think differently. And that is a necessary sensory interaction when you have so many media happening as extensions of your senses. So, okay, so I'm trying to get to the point of what is MKUltra? Historically, it did this or that, or papers were released. Who's being controlled now, and what's the issue? And now, over the past year, you know, we had Wall Street collapse. And now Goldman Sachs is in trouble. So these issues are Walter Bowert wrestled with. He really, he was detached about the meaning of his book, at least by the 80s. And if you look at his revised edition, he gets into a lot of McLuhan stuff. He puts the tetrad, a formula that McLuhan laid out. He ends the book talking about me. Have you seen that revised edition?
No, I haven't. I've been trying to get my hands on it.
Yeah, maybe James has an extra copy or something. Mine's all in Connecticut in the warehouse. I have not bought my books over yet. But anyways, this, now I want you to start to engage with this question. You know, that what we all are like Walter Bowert now. We are quadriphenic. We are famous within our little range of publication. There's many other sites that are well-known like yours, right? And many other media. Everybody's got their little niche audience. And Bowert was dealing with different audiences. He did magazines, he did fiction, he did journalism, he did social life, he did investigative stuff, he went to the fringes. You know, all over the place. We, each one of us now, the average informed internet, computer, iPod, mobile user, is all over the place. Okay? So what is the definition of the reality, power, and control, and wealth in that situation? This is what Walter represented. He was the only guy of his generation who really, became famous enough to be harassed personally and spied on and monitored and suppressed, but still was able, because in this fragmented, decentralized society, he still could have a great life. He had a great life enjoying himself out in Arizona and in Washington State and all over the place, had great friends and all that. It's not like 1984 where you're in a little prison, you know, the guy in 1984, a little cubicle, and you can't even have sex with his girlfriend. You know what I mean? The chemical body is what George Orwell is worried about being controlled, but what is the control when you have a TV body and a chip body, which are appendages of the media environments that have grown up the last 150 years and have shrunk? They used to be massive environments. They're still massive environments, almost like an afterimage. That's the role of CBS in that. But in our actual lives, they're all just little things in your hand, little landscapes, little media that are tiny. So they are smaller than your chemical body, but they're still there. They affect the economy and everything. So we're juggling these four bodies: the chemical body, the astral body, which is the idea that there's more than this, and then your TV body and chip body, and they're all interact, and that's the extension of quadriphenia. And Walter Bowert, we all have the Walter Bowert syndrome.
So, Bob, could you go over quadriphenia again? It's such a new idea to me.
Okay.
I sort of had it when you went through it, but then I lost it.
Okay, so you have conflicting desires in yourself. Everybody does. In classical Greece, the antinomies, the contradictions of existence, whether to follow your own will or to follow the group's will, or how much to be yourself and how much to engage with somebody, how much should you be ethical, how much does it matter to be ethical, all those questions that came in with the beginning of literacy in Greece were philosophically laid out as the classical polarities, and the Greek and Roman thinkers never could solve them, how to figure out how to get past the contradictions of life. And so you had different responses. You could be a Stoic, you could be a Sophist, you could be a Hedonist, you could be an Epicurean, all those different philosophical schools. You could be a Cynic, the school of Diogenes, the guy who went around with the barrel, just wearing a barrel, looking for an honest man. This was resolved by St. Augustine, because you had the phonetic alphabet in the manuscript culture, what McLuhan calls visual space, going on for like 600 years by that point, by the time of Augustine. So what did he do? He said, I'm going to get out of this classical dialectical contradictory tension and go to a third space. And he called it the soul. And he said, there's this third space, the individual soul, that is only imaginable if you're a literate society and you have this literate abstraction space. It's an effect of the alphabet and the manuscript. You have this abstracted space that pre-literate people never had, and that abstracted space takes on a life of its own. It's called a soul. So St. Augustine resolved this doubleness, these contradictory impulses in people, whether to be loving or to be angry in different situations, by setting up the meme of the manuscript culture known as Christianity. You had a third soul, and you focus on the third part, the soul, and its ethical mandates from Christianity to resolve the endless battle. Now the printing press comes along, 1,000 years later, and intensifies the effect of this soul, And I'm just moving quickly. And in the 20th century, when the printing press is superseded by electric media, the doubleness that's always in humans, that the printing press and Augustine's concept of soul temporarily assuaged, in a general sense, not for everybody in the West, that gets superseded by the electric environment going around and being more powerful than the book. So the doubleness that's always in humans comes back stronger because it cannot be contained in the effective literacy or the Christian idea of the soul. You follow what I'm saying? That abstract self collapses. And you can see, you know, at the beginning of the ninth of the 20th century, the philosophies start dealing with this. Wittgenstein comes in, says, of that which we cannot know, you cannot speak. And then existentialism comes in, and that's the major thing. The existentialist idea that we have, what ethics can you go on? I don't believe in the Christian soul. Nietzsche began that movement. And I'm living in this electronic process of processual environment of process and flux and flow of much information. What is my perspective? Can I have a perspective? And what would be my ethics? And existentialism said, well, it's up to you to figure out your ethics. So you have a beginning of fragmentation of social consensus. So the doubleness that was suppressed by Christianity comes back strong in the electric age. And then we watch the evolution of digital media. So media starts to shrink and it becomes your little body and it actually replays the doubleness back to you. I mean, I like to point out Crossfire. Remember that? In the early 80s, Crossfire? Here were these two points of view. Every night, they robotically go at each other from their defined fanaticisms, left or right, and they cancel each other out every day and go on 5 days a week for many years. That showed you the doubleness incarnate, but it's in the Enderer meme. You're watching it. You're watching the doubleness. And in the new in journalistic land, it became very common for journalists or commentators to say, well, this is what's happening, but it could be this. But it could be that, but it could be this. I mean, you could always say many points of view are always presented in journalism for 100 years or so, but it became more rapid. Everybody became aware that you didn't need to really find out what the right answer was. You just create the tension of the argument every day, right? And the tension of the argument... the Enderer meme, the tension of the doubleness would be splashed at everybody in the media in all kinds of forms, even like in Donahue or Oprah's show. The tension of doubleness was a process everybody engaged in, but there was no way to resolve it because you're watching it happen in an external environment called the media. All right?
Okay.
So the doubleness in the media that doesn't get resolved, we've retrieved Greek sensibility. Because pre-literate people don't have a problem with doubleness. It's only if you go through the literate phase, you have a problem with doubleness. And, anthropologists would ask, you know, pre-literate people, Aboriginal natives and that, their definition of, okay, what do opposites have in common? You'd ask a primitive person. No, I won't say primitive, pre-literate. They'd say oppositeness. Okay? What do opposites have in common? Oppositeness. They could see the complementariness of opposites. They were naive. They hadn't been processed by literacy, which then would fragment them into hypertension and what we call schizophrenia, if it's considered a pathology. Post-literate people retrieve an awareness of the complementariness and the oppositeness of opposites, and they're not so uptight about the dialectic, but they are in a culture that's literate and they have to keep that going in their psychology, but they take on the newer aspects of flow that the chip body and TV body show us. So, they have the doubleness acted out in the Android meme or the mixture of the TV and chip body, mirroring your own doubleness. Okay? And that leads to incredible tensions in people so that they start doing all the excessive behavior that's considered excessive by Nancy Reagan, okay, or any other authority, or Michelle Obama. I mean, everything's off the chain. Okay, so I'm calling the interaction of your own doubleness with the media replay of the doubleness right back at you. Because remember, back in literacy, read a book, consider the argument, write a letter to somebody, they consider your argument, write it back, it would take 6 months. There's that famous line, but Jefferson and them say, We better write a letter to Benjamin Franklin in Paris. We haven't heard from him in a year. Okay? We haven't heard from him in a year. Look, it's so slow compared to today. We don't even have time and space electronically anymore. Back in the literate age, you had a bit of time and space and you try to resolve the antinomies, the polarities. Okay, so you have this doubleness in the media. You have your own doubleness. That makes four. That's quadruphenia. You got it? It's the juggling of your chemical body, your astral body, your TV body, and your chip body. These are environments you really, it's hard to disconnect from them. I mean, you live out there in where you live, I don't know if it's public, and you've got a pretty non-industrial environment you're living in, right?
Yes.
But you are providing major entertainment for the post-industrial society of the chip landscape, or the chip body.
Yes, we're just playing.
Yeah, we're just playing. And, okay, let's carry on. I've answered your, you now understand quadruphenia, right?
Yes.
It's what you live every day. It's not a disease. It can be a disease if you don't understand what it's doing, that you are quadruphenic. If you don't know that you're contradicting yourself, you'll get so stressed out, you'll become a fanatic of something. And that's been the main unforeseen effect by the Walter Boward counterculture in the 60s was the rise of religious fanaticism in all cultures all over the world, including scientific fanaticism or New Age fanaticism. That is people trying to maintain a point of view or get a perspective, retrieve their eyes in a world that's not visual anymore. Not visual in a sense, it's multisensory and mirroring you back. Okay? That's when you become a quadruphenic in trouble. But once you understand these four bodies and then juggle it, you can relax a bit about what's going on.
Right.
Okay, so you keep posting information that panics people. It could be interpreted as panic.
No. We're just posting information. If the people get panicked, that's their choice.
Yep, and a newspaper editor in the 19th century would never have said that. They would have said, we're putting out information that's important for people to learn, and we want our political party to get in power because we know what's right. They would never have said, hey, we're just putting out stuff. It's up to them to take it over, do what they want. You,
right, and if we were talking to them today, we would say, hey, that's old school.
Yeah, and they would look at your situation and look around and say, screw that, I'm going to make a newspaper and take over the world, like the Tea Party. And they would do it, and like Ron Paul, and get totally frustrated and give up and say, you're right, Ed. I'm just going to start putting out crap, and I don't care what people think of it. I was like, give me some new crap, Ed, that I can put out.
People just want something they can listen to on their iPods when they're out there. They want to be entertained.
They don't want to be entertained. That's their first part of the sentence is right. They want to hear something on an iPod. McLuhan used to say this in the 60s, that people turned on the radio back in the 50s and 60s not to hear what's on, but to engage the electronic space that they know everybody else is listening. It's like going to the park and seeing what's happening in the park, the commons. You just tune in, and you don't care what's being said, or you might, and you can switch to another channel, but the point is you're engaging that real electronic space that you know everybody else is listening to, and you got to find out what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether you get involved in the particular programs is another matter, but not as relevant as people turn on the radio just to tune in. And the content is the sensory stimulation. I get up and walk around to see what the weather is, to experience the day's weather, to entertain my senses, right? And I don't expect to stop that process. And I don't expect to have an opinion about it or make a big deal about it. That's how people engage information today. It's called...
Well, wouldn't you want to check with the weatherman to see how the weather is rather than check it out yourself? You need an expert opinion.
That's to keep the idea that something's valuable, to prop up the dollar. The weatherman props up the dollar like there is something valuable. There's something you need to know and have.
Or there's something that you need to know and have that you can't do on your own.
Yeah, because you don't want to think
you can't check the weather yourself. You need an expert to tell you if it's raining or not. You can't walk outside and see if it is.
Now, let me point out the fallacy in that irony. You're making an ironic situation. Yeah. Now, you're saying people ignore their chemical body and they don't trust their chemical body, so they got to listen to the TV landscape or TV body to see what it tells us. But it's mistaken to think the weatherman is telling you about the weather for your chemical body. They're so wrong, you would think people, if they were serious, wouldn't listen to weather. But that's not why they watch the weather. They want to see what's happening on, they turn on the weather to find out what's going on, not in their neighborhood, to find out what's happening on TV.
Oh.
You get that?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can make jokes about people, you know, why don't they trust their chemical body? Well, the people are smart. They're not going to trust their chemical body. They don't care what's happening to their chemical body. And if they do, they wouldn't list the weathermen, so most people don't care, really, because they're more interested in engaging the sensory life of their TV or chip body. And that's why they watch the weathermen. They watch, they know he's not right, and they make jokes about him, and they look at his hairstyle or her cleavage or whatever, you know. They just enjoy the scenario. Nothing to do with the content, per se.
Okay, so is it the same with the Internet, then?
Yes.
Are they just tuning in to see what's on the Internet?
You know, can you imagine, you know, in the small towns of America, you know, 100 years ago, people at some point in their day would go down to the well, so to speak. They'd go out to the general store or into the park to see what's going on today, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're grazing. You're just scanning the environment. That's what the Internet is, a huge, powerful environment. It's a commons. And you go on and graze and just look around and see if something burnt down or someone got murdered or did you get ripped off or... They raise the taxes, you know, the general concerns of society. That's the purpose of it. And it's as important as apples and vegetables. We have four stomachs. Look at the four bodies. You've got to feed your chemical body stomach. You've got to feed your astral or spiritual stomach in whatever way. Even being an atheist can be a form of spiritualism. It's a value seeking beyond the immediate. And then you have your TV stomach and your chip stomach. And they all must be fed. And if you're confused about that, you will be a quadriphenic on the negative side. If you do understand what you're juggling and have figured out your relationship to it and, quote, know what's important, and that's very hard to figure out, Ed, when you're quadriphenic, but at least you know you can't figure it out because there's too much going on, that's a healthier, more slackful position. Okay, back to more content and issues and history, because remember, I started... My show in Toronto in 1984 started this range of fringe information. My colleague Bob Marshall featured Mae Brussel, Lynn LaRouche, Dr. Beter, Sherman Skolnick, Cosmic Awareness, Dave Worster, Cosmic Awareness version, Dave Worster, all kinds of other stuff on the radio in Toronto, and no one had ever heard that kind of information in immediately popular or accessible media. So I started, and I was one of the first. There was a few others. They usually were jokers, though. You had Negative Land on San Francisco radio doing collages, very effective multi-editing of stuff. But they weren't presenting it seriously in a journalistic mode, which is what Bob Marshall and I were doing. When I moved to New York City in 93, my friend Jim called me up. He left a message. I didn't get to talk to him, but he said, "Hey, Bob, there's this show on TV called X-Files. It's all your stuff. It's major TV now." Okay. Here, I'll say this. Ed, let me say this. What I mean is what I started. I was the first to present conflicting points of view and bizarre points of view all in one program. So people used to wonder if Bob Marshall, you know, what was his opinion? You know, they expected that you knew what you were about and you had an agenda. We had no agenda in particular to a point of view. You know what I mean? Which is what Walter Boward kind of did with East Village Other.
See? Yeah, but I mean, even the idea of considering an opinion now is old school.
Yeah, yeah. And old school is the world of schools and literacy and educational system. It's literally the people who believe there have to be schools. Okay, so let's...
Well, how do you feel about this thing that you've unleashed in 1984, and now that it's grown up, or it's still growing up, I guess?
Well, it's the old adage in advertising. Advertising creates a disease and offers a cure, okay? They tell you your breath is bad, and that's a bad problem, and so therefore you better take mints or something to solve your breath problem. That's the principle of the 20th century. Create a disease and offer the cure. Well, I was creating a disease in 84, and I had the cure. The cure was my perspective, and I moved over to another show. Bob Marshall continued on the international connection newsy stuff, and I presented the Bob Dobbs perspective. And that show, you can hear those old tapes, I presented a different way. I was intuiting what the internet was saying, what the internet as a medium was going to do to people. I acted out before the internet came. I said that I was in charge, I was running the world, and this is what I was doing to you. Okay? So that was a temporary solution. And that worked for many years, but when the economy crashed in 2008, you really had to come up with a new solution because it was nobody knew what to do. When Wall Street, the modern god, collapsed, what the hell, you know? What do we do now? Can we even have money? Well, I came...
You were the cause of that, though.
Yeah, well, that's a subset. I'm just making this general pattern. So I created a solution. I came up with the solution of the death of the Android meme. The Android meme and the information society and the information economy collapsed in 2008, symbolized by the collapse of the houses of Wall Street, and they're still trying to drag down the last guy, Goldman Sachs, right now. The solution was the breakthrough of ION. Actual non-physical showing up as a technological environment. Our non-physical self was externalized as a technological environment, and that's what I call ION. And that is the solution, because we're bringing forth cold fusion and all kinds of things. So I created the disease, offered different solutions over the last 25 years, and then triumphantly capped it off with a better solution, the interplay of Bob and Carolyn and James and ION. And I triggered the Android meme and laid out its pattern, and then it just, you know, ramped through the world through the 90s and into the 2000s as the internet culture or web 2.0, whatever you want to call it. It was technology out of control, information out of control, and people feeling that they could personally create their own media spaces. That was the seduction of the Android meme. Meme means a general cultural idea. The Android meme was technology presenting that to you and seducing you, saying you can create your own media space. You don't have to listen to Dan Rather or these idiots. And that's what Rush Limbaugh came in on that. Rush Limbaugh came in late 80s, early 90s. He was a poor man's internet. He said, you don't want to hear about mainstream media. It's all controlled. I will tell you what it is. And he was smart enough or logical enough or informed enough to present a Native American archetypal idea of individualism, self-initiative. And that imitated what the Android meme was giving. It was allowing you to create your own media on your own initiative. Okay, so next point. I'm trying to get you into the wrestling with the question that Boehrert did. Who's somebody, you want to know about Dr. Beter? Like, I'm saying, look in...
Yeah, sure.
Dr. Beter...
And the relationship to cosmic awareness.
Oh, how do you know about that?
Well, when I was researching this idea of what Beter was talking about as far as synthetic humans or robotics.
Organic robotoids, yeah.
Yeah, organic robotoids. Then awareness was saying similar information.
Okay, now that is a key. That is a big issue. I could go on for hours about the background to that and Beter and awareness. So we need to say, you can go on one of my sites called Dobbstown.com, and you can listen to an interview with David Worster. It's 24 hours, done over a stretch of time. It adds up to 24 hours. You've listened to it. You were pretty impressed. That gives the background to how cosmic awareness occurred. And the first medium for cosmic awareness was Ralph Doobie, the second was Dave Worster, and the third was Paul Shockley. Paul Shockley started in 1975, and he became very well known out in the fringe world of the 70s and 80s. And so if you say cosmic awareness, people will refer to Paul Shockley's channeling.
I was talking about Paul Shockley.
Right. You didn't know before you met me there even was a David Worster, or you might have known about Doobie. Did you know about Ralph Doobie from Paul's channelings?
No.
Okay. So Paul Shockley had... I knew Paul Shockley in the late 60s and early 70s in Seattle. I met him through the Dave Worster era, called the Dave Worster era. Paul was a student of Dave Worster and all that. And and Avaton, an older member of the Ralph Doobie, that was the phase before Dave Worcester, he was down in Olympia, Washington, and he didn't like what Dave was doing with his channeling, so he asked Paul, or encouraged Paul, to start channeling, or Paul did it on his own, and Avaton started publishing it out of Olympia, so it no longer was based in Seattle. But I remember talking to Paul, and he was the first person in that group around Dave Worcester who talked about the Rockefellers and that. He was studying that. Back then, it would have been the John Birch view of things, right? And the John Birchers were worried about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and that. So he, I don't know where he got it from, but he was interested in that. And so when he started channeling, he very beginning in 75, 76, started talking about the changes coming to the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, that there were agents of light within those Illuminati levels or elite levels. So he always had that conspiratorial stuff. So that led he and Avaton and readers of Cosmos into discovering LaRouche's information. They discovered Dr. Beter's information. So Avaton would interview Paul Shockley in France, channeling Cosmos, about the LaRouche stuff, about Beter. So they were the first to glom on to Beter's stuff. Beter was putting out the tapes in the late 70s, and Cosmos was probably the only people that knew about it. I mean, not many people were listening to Beter in the population. And so they helped popularize Beter, and they took Beter at face value. They believed what he said, and awareness validated. Supposedly, Cosmic Awareness coming through Paul Shockley validated Beter's stuff. And Beter found out about this, and I knew Beter back then. Beter found out about this, and I didn't tell him. He just found it. I guess Cosmic Awareness, the Avaton, sent some literature to Beter, to Dr. Peter Beter, which makes everybody laugh, right? Peter Beter. So Dr. Beter, he gets this information from Cosmic Awareness. He sees Cosmic Awareness is talking about his stuff. Now, he already had mystical inclinations. He studied some Swami in Boston in the 60s, you know, when the first Eastern gurus were coming over. He got involved with one. And when he passed on in 1987, I went to his home in Washington, in Bethesda, was it? Yeah, Bethesda. And his wife, Lily, gave me his books, the religious books that he studied with the Swami, and gave me some other personal stuff. So I know Beter was into that. So he wasn't, you know, he was a lawyer and a serious gold expert and all that stuff, and all that left hemisphere kind of thinking. He could do that, but he had a right hemisphere interest in mysticism, so it wasn't foreign for him to read something about like something coming from Cosmic Awareness. So once he told me he was doing Cosmic Awareness, it just came up, oh, you know them, and blah, blah, blah. So, and I knew them, so we would talk about it, and he loved the readings, and I guess he believed it, or he believed in himself. But here's the secret thing about Beter. He stops in 1980, and he had to for various pressures, and he got involved in looking for and making gold deals for the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. She was looking to acquire gold. And so from 82, yeah, he didn't stop in 1980, he stopped in 1982. In late 82, he had predicted the assassination of Sadat in October 81. I think he predicted the death of Brezhnev and whoever took over Andropov, or the guy before Andropov, whatever. So he sort of went out with the final accurate prediction. And his associates carried on the newsletter for another year, and they predicted Gorbachev. But Beter wasn't involved with that, really. He quit. He gets involved with high finance again, and he does that until 1986, and he has no media profile. He's not letting anybody know what he's thinking or doing. And I called him up in February 86 and said, I'm not going to ask you. I want to do an interview with Bob Marshall on CKLN in Toronto, and we want to interview you not about what's happening now, because I know you won't talk about that. Let's go into what this thing you did with the Dr. Beter audio letter, what happened to your life? You know, what good things, what bad things happened to you? So I addressed him personally about himself, and he agreed to that. So we did that on February 20th, 1986, and it was broadcast. But he said during that interview, He said, Bob, we have $14 billion, and we want to buy some gold, and we cannot find 1 ounce of gold in the world. We're telling you, Bob, you know anybody's getting gold, we'll buy it. And the fact that we can't find it, that should tell you something, Bob. Okay, that's on the interview. So a person in the audience heard that interview when it was broadcast. And in December 86, he called me up. He was a Toronto businessman. And he said, I got someone who's got gold. And maybe Beter would be interested. So I was a go-between. So Beter and I and the Toronto guy got involved with the Queen's representative. And from December 14th, 86, we arranged to get the gold and pay it off and all this stuff. And then right in the middle of it, on March 13th, going into March 14th, Beter dropped dead. 1987. So I went to see his wife and family, and was around for the service and all that, and had access to some of his notes. After Beter stopped doing his tape, and this is a world exclusive, I don't think anybody has ever, I mean, I might have said this on the radio show way back in the late 80s, early 90s. He told me, Bob, what everybody misses about my tapes, what's that? They miss that it is riddled with Hindu symbolism. In other words, look at the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Bolsheviks and the new Christians coming out of Russia that Gorbachev represented in Beter's scenario, his typography of power, right? It was a battle between the Rockefellers, the Bolsheviks, the Skopsi, Christian Skopsis in Moscow. And they shift around and the Rothschilds be in between. Look at them as Hindu gods, and they create worlds and then they collapse them, or they get eaten up themselves. Think of it as iconography, like you would see in Hindu culture. The point is that he said, if you say that it's symbolic, does that mean the information is all made up, that there's no such thing as organic robotoids? Does it mean that's a metaphor for something, or does it mean it's true, but the dynamic between the factions has a moral to it, based on his Hindu studies, Beter's Hindu studies. You see? So that's something that no one knows about, and if anybody's into Beter and they listen to this, then they can start thinking about it, and we can talk about it, but I'm just telling you what he said about it. It was a great art form, his audio letter.
Well, was this a creative exercise, or where did he get his information about organic robotoids?
Oh, he definitely got information from sources, and good sources and dangerous sources. This is sort of known if you look into Beter's world, you can find documentation of this. Rockefeller, I think it was Nelson Rockefeller's secretary, was one of his sources. And when Beter started to investigate no gold being in Fort Knox in 73, 74, in the middle of that, when Beter started to get publicity, she was murdered. Nelson's secretary. And one of the Rockefellers, I assume it was Nelson, might have been David, but that was one of Beter's sources. So it was serious, what he was doing. And so it was interesting, I knew Beter before Bowert, before Walter, but what Beter went through, starting his audio letter, see, he did the investigation of Fort Knox, they had the public thing, and didn't lead anywhere, and then he couldn't get on the media anymore, so he started making his audio letter in June 75 to get out his information on the ongoing battle between the Rockefellers, the Bolsheviks, and the Christian Skopsis, the Russian Skopsis. So he was on his own from that point on. So he got harassed because of that. And he might have got murdered and all that. The point is that he went through the Walter Bowert syndrome. He was older than Walter Bowert, but he went through the media dynamic of trying to inform people about what's really going on and suffered the slings and arrows of fate there, just like Walter had done a few years before. May Brussel went through the same thing. LaRouche went through the same thing. They all went through it. So
have you been spared all this time?
Well, I was the guy doing it to everybody. My team. Let me show you an interesting thing. Do you watch 24? No, you probably don't watch TV. just for those of West 24, it's come to an interesting point. The main character, Jack Bauer, he's the hero, does everything better than anybody else and saves everybody and kills the bad guy all the time and keeps one crisis after another. Well, his friend Chloe has become head of the terrorist counterterrorism unit. So Jack is angry at what the president, Allison Taylor, I think it is, the woman president, is doing in relation to a peace deal in the Mideast. So he thinks that's corrupt what she's doing, so he's taking things in his own hands and hijacked the whole scenario. And this has pissed everybody off. And Chloe, now in a position of running the terrorism unit, she has to play the party line, so she has to be mad at Jack and go after him. So what you see in the series, she is leaking stuff to Jack so that he can do his hijacking, and at the same time linking to her employees who are out to trying to capture Jack. So she's leaking to both sides at the same time. And I don't know what's going to... It's come to a critical point, which will be on tomorrow night, the next episode, I assume. But I don't know if that's what she's doing, but I see it exactly what I call tetrad management. She's working many levels. If she's helping Jack, she has to cover her ass by proving she's helping the guys trying to catch Jack, right? So you can't tell, but she's like playing both sides at the same time and waiting to see what to do next. Because Jack's a close friend, she respects Jack, she doesn't want to bust him, but from the perspective of her responsibility in charge of the anti-terrorism unit, she's got to stop him. She's working for the president, he's not anymore, right? You get the dilemma? And it's exactly my situation. Play both sides, work all four sides, the quadriphenic, and try to have some kind of sense of achievement within that. Achievement or moral standard or ethic or feeling good about what you did. That's the situation. So what I did is I leaked information to all these people. I worked with Beter and May and everybody while, like Chloe, being part of the team that's hounding them. Now, you can see this in my diaries. I laid this all out. You ever seen my diaries?
I haven't seen the diaries.
Yeah, they're part of the timeline, but I don't want to get too distracted on that. But it's like McLuhan said. He said back in the 70s, if you were president of the United States, what would you do? This is a taping of a class at the University of Toronto. He said, what would you do if you were president? And everybody goes, the kids go, I don't know, I'd try to feed everybody, or some idealistic thing. And McLuhan says, no, you would do nothing. And they go, nothing? Why? How can you do something when you're responsible interacting with four or five worlds? And his four worlds were, the first world was the modern, most advanced capitalist societies. The second world was Russian bureaucracy. The third world was undeveloped third world, not really industrialized. And this is in the 60s, who's laying this out. And then the fourth world was the electronic world that goes around all three and disrupts all three. There's the four worlds you got to deal with when you're at the center of the Android meme, when you're the president. And what are you going to do? She's going to be an actor. You can't do anything. It's too conflicted, all the bureaucracy. So that's what McLuhan's getting at. Now, why did I bring that up? So that's my position. When I was head of Secret Council 10, you do nothing, but you look very busy. It's like you, Ed. You're very busy putting out new information every day.
That's right. <laughs> Okay,
so this will lead to more questions. So that's, okay, so Beter, he told me that he liked the Cosmere stuff. He didn't know about Dave Worster and what I consider, quote, a better medium than Shockley. That's controversial for me to say that, but I favored Worster. Worster was a great talker without being in trance. And what happened is when Ion came on, I knew I had to tell Dave about this eventually, so on April 5th, I think it was, I called up Dave Worster and started telling for the first time, I hadn't talked to him in 18 months, about what's happened to me with Ion. And his responses are incredible. He just was right tuned in, and he passed the test that I was subtly putting on him. And JW, the large for Ion, he heard the taping of this, and he was very impressed with Worster. Ion was already impressed with Worster. So anyways, Paul Shockley is dead, so he failed. He died. Dave Worster's still alive. He may be going blind, but he's still here. He's still a candidate for immortality in the physical. So Beter didn't know about Werther, but he sort of liked reading about himself through cosmic awareness. And he tried to take over the world with his gold deal. And so,
I didn't know that about Beter. I didn't know he was trying to...
Oh, yeah. And now here's what's interesting. Beter caused Ion in a way. Now, listen to this. So, okay, so if people have heard me talk about it on cash flow, how did Ion happen? Basically, JW, a very successful businessman in Georgia, he's 44 years old. So last year, he'd be 45 in August, so last year when he was 43, becoming 44, he started to see, first of all, he was looking out his window and the windows opened up and he started to see other worlds through his window. Now, I don't know what that consisted of, what his brain saw, but that's what he told me, and it was confidential. And then shortly after that, like in early 2009, he started seeing dead people hang around his home. And he told me this, you know, confidentially, you know, Bob, something's going on here. I thought you might be interested in. Hope you don't get upset. Hope you don't think I'm nuts. But he didn't say it like that, but that was his feeling. And he said, I can see dead people. And there's a guy, looks like he's a senior citizen of the 1940s, dressed like back in the 40s. And he's sitting there. And I said, well, can he talk? Can you speak to him? Yes, he'll talk to me if I speak to him. And then he describes the other ghosts, and I said, that's interesting. And that was that. And then a couple days later, he calls me up. He said, hey, Bob, a new dead person showed up. And I said, what? What do you mean, who? What? He said, Dr. Beter. I go, what? Yeah, Dr. Beter. I said, you don't know Dr. Beter? He said, no. But this guy showed up, and he said he was Dr. Beter, and he said to say hi to Bob. I go, what? That's incredible. Now, I had talked to Beter, who died in 1987, through the Evergreens in the late 80s and early 90s. I even taped a message from Beter in 1988 and went to Washington and other places, but dropped into Bethesda and played what Beter said to his wife and daughters and played it to him through the Evergreens. So Beter and I had an ongoing relationship through the Evergreens. So here is Beter showing up to JW and saying, say hi to Bob. And I hear that, I go, wow. And then I started thinking, maybe these entities are the Evergreens. You know, because they stopped coming through Michael Blake Reed. He shut it down in 2004. So we didn't have the great source of information from the Evergreens for 5 years. And here it is in 2009, in March. And Beter's coming through. So I get this ridiculous notion that the Evergreens are coming back. Okay? So I say this to JW, why don't you... Let's tomorrow, I'll call you up and we'll have a quiet time and you be quiet and I'm going to talk to these people. This is by phone. I'm going to talk to these people around you, see, maybe they're the Evergreens. And so we did that and the victory was announced and we have Ion and humanity's saved. But it was triggered by Dr. Beter showing up. And then I talked to Dr. Beter very quickly through Ion within a few week or something, in the first week or so. Had a long talk with him, and he laid out a lot of the particulars that I knew some of, but not all of, about what he and his buddies were trying to do. So all that stuff that he was talking about on his tapes, this battle between the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Bolsheviks, and the Christian Skopsky in Russia, were him reporting on the factions he was fighting against. He never told us that he was doing that. I knew that there was a potential, but he didn't even tell. That was top secret with he and his friend Colonel Curtis Dahl. You ever heard of Curtis B. Dahl? He did a book, my father-in-law, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He had a sort of a right-wing view of how he exposes what happened in the Roosevelt administration that was negative from his point of view, and he had access because he was married into the Roosevelt family or something. Curtis B. Dahl. And in retrospect, I remember Beter's wife... Lily telling me that, you know, Colonel Dahl and Beter would be in the den or in the office of Beter and they'd be yelling, screaming, talking about what they're going to do and take over this, take over that. I'd heard that, but I didn't know how purposeful it was. Now, Beter was aware of what I was doing. I sort of, took over the world. I don't want to go into all the levels of what that means, because that's all on the timeline. That's 20 years of tapes you can listen to. But Vito is doing something for whatever reason on his own that I wasn't aware of, and he did tell me at one point in the early 80s that maybe it's on that tape. No, this was confidential. That they got to the point, the big deal, where they were going to get all the gold or get a controlling position with his team, and the Rockefellers came in and made a move in South America that screwed Beter, and they lost. They lost. The Rockefeller outmaneuvered them. Whatever the Rockefeller team is, because by that time, it's the Bolshevik clones have taken over, right? So who knows what Beter was fighting against. He might have been fighting against organic robotoids, right? And being the only one to know that was happening, you would know that. You could maybe take it over. But anyways, the robotoids beat him, and it didn't work. But he filled in more about it and ended his talk with me saying, Bob, you're going to do it. And I'm glad to have been part of your past. And I tried. I did an early run. We didn't work, but you and your team are going to do it. So I got confirmation from Peter we're going to win.
Who are the Evergreens? The Evergreens are not awareness, right?
No, yeah. Okay, that's what Worster comes in. Worster always talked about, when I met him in the late 60s, about conscious mediumship. He wasn't into being an unconscious channel like Edgar Cayce. He did channel cosmic awareness, sort of unconsciously, and he'd do it for about 40 minutes a session. But he always was saying, I'm at a pretty good level of awareness when I'm not doing cosmic awareness. So I found that pretty interesting. It was the first time I ever heard of that. Though, if you study Krishnamurti, who Dave Worster knew and studied, Krishnamurti points towards that. You know Krishnamurti's writings?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Krishnamurti was a big influence, or cosmic awareness, liked Krishnamurti. So anyways, Worster, when I told him about the Evergreens, who I discovered in 1980, he said, that's just spirit stuff. You know, that's unconscious. I don't believe anybody is into entities or channeling entities, because I told him that the Evergreens said that they were 6,500 to 7,000 entities, and they spoke through Michael Blake Reed, first in Toronto and then in British Columbia. And that was from 1974 to 2004, 30 years. Dave Worster was never interested in that stuff, in mediumship. Though he watched TV every day and consciously thought he was interacting with what I would call the Android meme and making moves in relationship to it. Now that's a whole long story, which is another tapes, but there was a crossing of contact between the Evergreens and Worster, because Dave's buddy, Vern Christensen, later called Chris Christensen, who was the guy who controlled the microphone when Dave was in trance, they were lovers, and when Vern died, Vern's sister eventually wanted to talk to him, so Dave asked me, Bob, do the Evergreens talk to dead people? You know, can you do that? And I said, yeah. So he set up a reading for Vern's sister to talk to Vern, and so Dave listened into it. It was probably done in his apartment in Everett, Washington. And after, he told me, he said, I was impressed with the Evergreens. They were right on about certain things, because when they talked to the sister and Dave, they both knew the life of Vern, and he was impressed. But that's all. That was that. But he did get to experience them, you know, just eavesdropping. And they got their message from Chris Vern Christensen, later called Chris. He got to communicate to his sister and to David. Okay, so that's the only interaction between Dave and the Evergreens. But what's interesting is, if what cosmic awareness as it came through Worster was accurate, there wasn't really a need of the Evergreens. So I always considered the Evergreens as the Android meme replay of great mediumship. You follow what I'm saying? Because the Evergreens, Michael Blake Reed, he was the first medium I came across who, in 1980, could do it on the phone, tape the stuff, sent you tape recordings. It was so high-tech, you'd go to his place where he did the readings, and a beautiful sound studio, like most New Age people who had mediumship, were flakes, tape recorder wouldn't break or wouldn't go or they couldn't write. You know what I mean? Ever seen some of that flaky stuff in the 70s?
Sure.
The Michael Blake Reed and his wife, second wife at that time, Philippa, really had an amazing high-tech operation. And so good. They're the hidden ground behind what's that movie? Men Who Stare at Goats? The Men Who Stare at Goats, that whole operation was a distraction from the Evergreens on purpose by the intelligence agencies. So because they were high tech and the Evergreens could talk science and detail and just like Ion can, it just was way more advanced than normal mediumship. You go back and read, or even now you look at transcripts of older mediums or the flakier mediums, they talk about we're divine and you're not and you could become divine like us and this and that and gobbledygook. You know what I mean? You follow what I'm saying? And that's in the, I'm talking in the 70s and 80s. A lot of the mediums are, quote, mediums are better now, more sophisticated because people are more, not so cliche in their response to it. Okay, so the Evergreens were incredible. And that was a high-tech consultancy. And they had clients in 19 countries. They did over 11,000 readings, I think. And everyone is taped and in a master vault. They helped me in my intelligence work. I used them all the time, but I always thought that since it was a it was the android mean crazy information world, that they were part of it. They were the only way to get a perspective on the lost world of information we were in, starting in the 80s. They had the outside perspective, so you could find out. But even that, they did not become hugely big. They weren't on Oprah or anything, you know. They remained important, but on the fringe. Even important information like that doesn't get a big focus spotlight on because of the obsolete Android mean. I mean, the obsolescence of information in Android mean conditions. Okay, so I always thought it was the Android mean replay, that their reads were part of the high-tech world the last 30 years. So then they stopped in 2004. The Android mean collapses. And what's left? And then Ion showed up. And Ion says he's here to, Ion, says they're not 6,000 or 7,000 entities. They're not even entities, but if you want to consider us entities, we're a zillion entities. We're everybody. And so they show up to complete cosmic awareness and complete the Evergreens and complete the Abrahams and Seth and all the other great mediums, and Edgar Cayce. It's a wrap-up. I consider Ion the Howard Cosell of the emptying of the guff, you know, of the singularity of 2012, or whatever you want to call this implosion we're experiencing. Okay, here's what's interesting. Cosmic awareness was not an entity. It was, if you look back at the definitions, it was non-physical. That's what it was saying. We're not entities. We're the thing that everybody is, and more. We're awareness, cosmic awareness. Whereas the Evergreens offered entities, had the same message pretty well. But I see Ion as an extension of the cosmic awareness principle. If you think of cosmic awareness as not a entity, you get what I mean? And so I was surprised when Ion first started talking with Carol and I about how he brought up cosmic awareness and Dave Worster and complimented Worster, and that was pretty interesting. And he complimented the Evergreens. And I see Ion as a synthesis of all these strange things I went through. Not necessarily strange, really, from my opinion, but, you know, obscure sources, esoteric sources of information. So you see Beter is part of that. Beter knew about the Paul Schottky cosmic awareness. He didn't know about the Worster. Worster's part of it.
Yes. So am I picking up then from what you're saying that the intelligence communities, that they're getting their information from these entities or from non-physical?
What happened is, you know, the famous, Schnabel who wrote the book in 95 about remote viewing, the CIA use of psychics and remote viewers. You know that famous book? That's all about the gang at Stanford, you know, around
right.
Those Scientologists, supposedly. Some of them were Scientologists. Hal Puthoff and Dean somebody, and who are these guys? What's their names? They're all famous in the remote viewing world. Anyways,
Ingo Swann.
Yeah, those guys. Well, my opinion on this matter is that it got leaked or it got written up that the remote viewing was going on there, but it's a normal CIA or DIA or NSA strategy to point the finger over there and say, "Oh, you found out about what we were doing over there," so that you don't notice what's happening in the opposite corner of the room. I think the opposite corner of the room was the Evergreen. I mean, I know that government people had readings with Canadian cabinet ministers had readings with the Evergreens. Once you find out about it, you use it. Especially in an information society that's so out of control, you don't know what's going on, even if you're the president. So you got to use any means necessary, or at least consider them. And so now the intelligence agencies are using ION. They're monitoring us. They know what we're doing. They know the value of it. They know it's prophecy. They know it's part of what's going on. They know they can't control things, but they'd like to get a form of control, so maybe ION could help. Maybe they will just, through ION, get a greater acceptance that they can't control things. So where does this leave the Illuminati and what Bill Deagle talks about? Where's that all? What's that to worry about?
What Bill Deagle is saying, does that have value?
It has great value if you have a computer and you need new content every day. It's a very important part of our economy. You got to keep the workers happy while they're in their boring computer jobs. They got to have alternative stuff to stimulate their brain, you know, to most people maybe don't even require that. I mean, there's not millions of people listening to, or not, what you know, the ratings for Project Camelot are not as high as Oprah, right? So majority of people listen to Oprah to get a sense of what the weather is, the weather in the TV landscape. But there are lots of people listening to Project Camelot, and they require unique, eccentric information before they consider it a new day or a new weather. David Icke came in on that. He provided eccentric reading for books.
Yeah, but I don't see him in the same league as Beter.
No, Beter was Beter was real. See, anything. Now that's something else I want to go into. You know, people read. You know, we have many people who come to ION because they listen to Project Camelot. They're shocked since 9/11 at what's happened to the world and what's happened to America, and they want to know who's doing it. And they go to places like Project Camelot or Alex Jones or Coast to Coast and find out interesting new perspectives they never heard of about who's doing what to who. And they might get depressed, or they might be excited for a while, but then they get bummed out and they want an answer. So they then hear James Martinez's interview about Walter Boehr, and then they discover cash flow, and then they hear ION, and they say, oh, there's a whole different way of dealing with this, knowing the stuff, but being not bummed out about it. But when you're studying Bill Deagle or any of these other sites, you've entered into the Android meme phase since 1980, say, and you don't know how to think about this stuff unless you go through the real period of real information, when information mattered, that would be in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and study people like Mae Brussels and McLuhan, who show you when information mattered, what was really going on, and how to think about it. And, you know, occasionally if I listen to a talk show like Alex Jones or Coast to Coast, the people call in and they're trying to figure it out, and they don't have the thinking apparatus, the training to how to sort it out and to know the basic structure of the history of the last 150 years. That you can only acquire by a rigorous study of someone like Mae Brussels. I mean, Mae Brussels is probably the greatest journalist, singular journalist in the history of the United States. It's just incredible what she laid out. And she did her work every day, read 10 newspapers and documents, connected the dots and backed it up with documents and all this stuff. You've got to be literate to get that perspective. And actually to try to get the connections between things that bureaucracies are doing to you behind the scenes requires reading and knowing how to be, you know, sophisticated and literate. Most people can't be that today. They're not going to put that much energy in it. They don't have time because they've got to juggle their four media bodies. They're never going to be able to think in the linear way Mae developed, in multi-level way, as they ponder these questions. So it just becomes titillation. So on my chart, I recommend Mae Brussels and Lynn LaRouche, only because LaRouche's organization is a cult, but they are literate people, and they have a pretty good international news organization. And I used to watch how Mae would get some aspects, and LaRouche would fill in the other aspects, or they'd overlap. And then you have Beter come in on his level. Peter May, LaRouche, Skolnick up till 1988, up till the death of Mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington. Skolnick was pretty good. After that, he just got taken over by disinformation and ended up lost. But he, like everybody else, was lost in the Android meme. But I cite Mae Brussels and these people and Beter as, if you want to know how to think about the Illuminati and what they were doing when there was an Illuminati, there isn't really anymore, you've got to go back to those people if you want to do it. So it's like a hobby. But it is not what you learn from them how to look at the top-down control of information, which is very minor now. Is anybody in control right now? Only on the level of rumor. Like take Benjamin Fulford. Here's an exclusive for you. I may have said it somewhere else, but who is he fed information by? Henry Paulson. He doesn't know it, but he's getting distorted information from Henry Paulson, former Secretary of the Treasury. Why is Paulson doing that? He's feeding. You could say, the more practical way, is that there is no power structure unless you hear about them. How do you hear about them? They're cracking down on people. They're implementing the law. Well, who are they doing that to? Criminals. Well, they've got to be criminals to keep the law functioning. So the whole pointing of fingers and complaining that you're being investigated keeps the law image going. So if you want an idea, I mean, Henry Paulson has no power now, nothing. He's nobody. But to function in the credit world, he's got to pretend that he is part of an ongoing power structure. So he feeds information that there is a power structure that's doing things behind the scenes. So you get someone like Benjamin Fulford, you don't get some Dan Rather, you get someone on the fringe because everybody's looking to the fringe. The fringe media is like our samostat, like in Russia. The people didn't believe major media, they believed the samostat, right? Your sites and Project Camelot are the samostat of the West and the global village or the global theater. So you keep the image that there's something to be exposed going. And that's how the leaders keep an image of power, by having people complain about them. You get that? Now, this is a major point that the French thinker Foucault laid out, and Jean Baudrillard played with it, the French postmodern school. They laid this out in the 80s, because they were trying to figure out what happened in the 1968, May 68 revolution. Why did they lose? You know, and they started reading McLuhan and figured out there was a media dynamic us literate guys didn't realize. Media mean electronic media. Okay, so did you get my point that there's no power to Henry Paulson unless you believe that he was part of something that had power, and he still has that power, and then there are people who know he has that power, and they're going to expose Paulson. That's Chris Story and Benjamin Fulford or anybody else who does that. That's the pattern. So Ion comes along and says, you are in charge of your own universe. You create your own reality and all that. And that is technically what is going on with the internet. Everybody can create their own information pattern. You do that on your site. So the metaphysical statement by Ion that you are creating your own universe is a technical fact in reality in the way we live in our communication society. So it's the right time to have that said. Now, Abrahams and other mediums have said this, but Ion says that, but at the same time tells you what's going on in the Henry Paulson world. Right there in cash flow, gives you all the details, because it includes the need to know today's information pattern, right? Even though it's only that part of you that thinks there's an outer world going on that you need to keep track of. Most people can't go totally solipsistic and say, I'm creating my own reality, I don't care what you think of it, right? You juggle. There's your doubleness. Juggling the inner, your own making of reality, with a bit of acknowledgement of the outer reality. So all that I've said brings us back to James standing there with Walter on September 11th, and Walter saying, Bob and McLuhan are geniuses, they're right. And then the next day saying, Bob and McLuhan are idiots, especially Bob, he's an idiot. Well, I wasn't talking to Walter around 911. I probably didn't talk to him until James called me in spring 2008. 2002, and I might not have talked to Walter since early 2000. So maybe there was a two-year gap, and he had gone to Santa Monica and was living with James and trying to get the movie going of Operation Mind Control. So he's staring at this guy saying this, and then James reports this to me and introduces himself in spring of 2002, and it was fun and funny to listen to this because it did. I knew exactly Walter's dilemma. See, Walter, he did not respect the use of mediumship on the surface, even though he had psychic experiences himself. So he wasn't interested in the evergreens and all that. So he would get mad that he would say to Jane, "Bob's using those stupid evergreens, blah, blah, blah." I played him some evergreens in 91 when he visited me in Toronto, and I played him what the evergreens said about the history of MKUltra. And his very topic, and he didn't like what the evergreens said. It was tough. You know, they say the truth will set you free, but the evergreens said it will first piss you off. So he didn't like what the evergreens said, and so he wasn't too responsive to it. So he would complain about, he would celebrate my McLuhan expertise, but then Bob cancels out by being involved with the psychic stuff. Well, I find out after Walter dies that Walter was using a medium secretly. The person came to me and told me, and that was pretty interesting. So what I see as the Walter Borg syndrome, and this is the larger meaning of this pattern, is he was a quadriphenic, an early quadriphenic. He would engage in psychic stuff, but as a journalist, he couldn't admit that. May Brussel and Skolnick were intuitive people who used psychic stuff and didn't confess it to anybody until they met each other and confessed it to each other in 1975. They used their own intuitive abilities, and so here's Walter doing it, but not keeping it, not telling anybody in the journalistic world, but in the world where he used the medium, he would talk about it and be that, and then he would talk about the media landscape to some people as an electronic journalist, and then he would talk about the secret stuff with other people, the LaRouche level. So he's juggling all these memes or patterns of looking at reality. A meme is a long-standing pattern. Like the idea there's a God, or every culture has the idea of a God, so that's a meme. McDonald's is a meme. It's the basic patterns of a culture that are passed on, like genes. So we're juggling all these memes on top of the observation of technology itself juggling the memes. Okay, so Walter is there wrestling with the bottom up is true, Bob and McLuhan are right about that, but Bob's top down, using the evergreens, that can't be valid, so forget the top down, so he's not a genius on the top down, okay, so he's wrestling with this. So James would call me every 6 months and we would talk about the effects of the cell phone and what was happening in Hollywood, and he'd talk about what Walter was up and down about, and that is the Walter Borg syndrome that I'm saying that we all are doing until last year when everything collapsed and nobody believed information. So you come back to 911. What did that mean to people? It meant that the sacred space of America on the TV landscape, because people flew all over the world and didn't really live just in America in the last 30 years, you know, it's a global theater, jet set people living and experiencing many cultures through tourism and all that. What was damaged? It was an image. The people who pulled off 9-1 knew that you just have to nail the image and it'll freak everybody out and do it on TV. So the effect of that on people, the image that America was safe, and then to get invaded like that, and note the first building they hit was the one with the TV tower on it. And so you have the collapse of people's collective TV identity. And then you have the Patriot Bill bringing in the surveillance technologies in the chip landscape, and then people reacting to that. But at the same time, they're able to blog and make their own media, so it's not total control. And then the control image of Wall Street collapses. So that is the final structure for what information is. So now everybody's into a whatever, you know, or I got to get a job and survive, and I don't know if there is any job out there. So you have that panic over the past year, and then a new technology shows up. People would call it a spirit, a channel medium. No, it's a technology. Because you had the extension of our central nervous system with electric media and then digital media, and you had the extension of the whole planet with the satellites. What about extending the non-physical, our spiritual part of ourselves, or what do you want to call it, the thing that unites people and that is what you're made up of and what you reside in when you transition. So the externalization of that, the final externalization, is Ion. And he's here to clean up all the fears and projections and assumptions that make you think that America's gone bad since 9/11. Remember what Ion says, the heavens were rejoicing when Wall Street collapsed, because now people could rely on their own ingenuity. Everybody from Beter to Mae Brussel and Walter and LaRouche and mainstream media, you all get killed by the Android meme. You know, we're all saying you become famous in 15 minutes and then you get abused. The rise and fall of famous slogans and cliches. Everybody got nailed. You couldn't beat the Android meme. Even Zappa. Frank Zappa was pretty aware of this process and had a humor about it, sense of humor about it. But that, do you realize that the information environment collapsed with the core idea of money disappearing? Because most people listened and paid attention to the media environment of the last 100 years for economic reasons, to find out where you could get something going or where you could make some money or what's happening to your job. It's all information was tied to, was the core staple of the economy. Currency didn't mean money, it meant currency of current news. Information was the economy, and that's collapsed. Now, the technologies are environments like the weather. They keep going on, they keep happening, but people are looking for a new kind of reason.
So we're weaning them off of money.
The money disappeared in the 1929-31 crash, and then money became public property. No, that's the welfare state. Everybody's guaranteed a basic check so they could survive in industrial societies. Then the digital environment came in the 70s, and you had digital money, which collapsed with Enron, which was making millions and billions by receiving loans that they were allowed to call profits. Okay, the contradictions of the virtual economy. And that collapsed finally. So digital, non-paper, non-gold-backed money collapsed in 2008. So we're not weaning them off the idea of money. We're weaning them off the idea that they are interconnected with other people for economic reasons, which is the province of the bankers and the space Jews and the Illuminati and everything, right? They run the purse strings. They run the Federal Reserve. No. It's more, who is the Oprah Winfrey? Oprah Winfrey is the economy. It's what the centralized image of who is the most exciting sort of and assuaging and pacifying source of information and comfort. That is the economy. And that collapsed. That's why nature responds to that. People are panicking and not really understanding how to respond to the present. And nature starts saying, okay, we're going to have to start ramping it up and rub it in your face that you can take control of the waves in the mountains. And if you don't, we'll go crash them. So we get nothing but volcanoes and earthquakes until we catch on to that. And that's, you know, all prophesied, you know, in different Nostradamus, the Hopi prophecy, the Christian culture, all these prophetic thing of the end times. Well, I like what Ion says. End times does not mean it's the end. It means the end of time. And time is money in the 20th century. So it's the end of the beginning. So it is really the end of being informed. And people search around for patterns of information to sort of figure out what's going on in the outer landscape, what's going on outside of themselves, because they don't totally believe it's all just their own making, their own reality, their own subjectivity. And that is what is weak. Nobody knows which outer kingdom they can put their gold in, personal and material gold, what they can invest in. So that is the end of time, money, and measurement. So Ion comes along, and, you know, he's like the McDonald's of the esoteric. He lays it all out, pushes it further than David Icke or anybody, brings in incredible scenarios, and all the time just saying, hey, it's perfect what's happening right now. Enjoy it. Enjoy the journey. So his message, its message is sophisticated and aware, and Ion says it gets its ideas from us. So it picked the right guy to begin with, me and Carolyn. We're one of the most informed people on the planet, and so he could work with our words and thoughts and then spew it out and add to it.
What do you think about Dave McGowan's series, Inside the OC, Laurel Canyon?
Oh, yeah. No, that's fun. I've read a bit of it. He's dealing with images. I mean, I've only scanned a bit of it. But you could say, okay, Zappa's father was in the military. Jim Morrison's father was in the military. All these people. If you were a baby boomer, and growing up in the 60s, the media environment, the global theater of the satellite mixed corporate media call of radio, TV, and computers, and all that was happening, that family, the chemical body's family, was so puny in controlling you, in influencing you. Kids went running all over the world looking for an image sponsored and supplemented by the TV environment. I mean, the whole thing was to get, the whole hippie culture was to, you know, raise up the beans and all that in San Francisco 67 and get Allen Ginsberg in and get on the media, and then the people would hear the message and then they would know all you need is love. You know what I mean? It was a naive idea based on literacy that my information will go to you and you'll be saved by it. They didn't know that the information environment was not geared that way since 1945. There was no stopping point. There was no, like, you know, Walter Cronkite's gathering information and broadcasting. And finally he says, wow, this press conference over there, they wrapped it up. They said it exactly right. They know what's going on. Stop the world. No more news. We're only going to focus on those guys. They got the answers. That's what people were naive about. The techno peasants of the new information society didn't know that information itself was obsolete in the sense that it was just meant to keep going. It didn't matter what you came up with. That's why scientists in the scientific establishment, you're a nut if you start claiming you have an answer, like a cancer cure or something. They understand from just experience. They don't understand it as comprehensively as McLuhan and myself are presenting it. They understand that, hey, you don't come up with an answer because then we lose our funding. We're here to be scientists and do research and development. That can't end. So we only say we're considering this new data. It looks very positive. Yeah, it's pointing that way. Uh-oh, here's some information from another lab that contradicts that. You know, no, red wine does hurt you. You know, this ongoing processing of information, which is laid out in Finnegan's Wake as a pattern of that book, is the nature of employment, learning a living. You don't learn, come to a destination. You don't decide this does that. So that's why science really, they can't defend what I'm saying they do. They don't say they're doing that. They claim they're looking for it. But in actual practical fact, they can't stop. So send more money to cancer research, more telethons and all that. Anybody who starts claiming they have something, that screws up the works and the efficient flow of everybody being a technician, a pawn in the medical enterprise. So in this processing of information, but for people in the 60s, it was mainly the TV screen, color TV. They're watching the devastating news. You know, and Frank Zappa and Jim Morrison, they were talented. They could take music and make something. It didn't matter. You could have had a Jim Morrison from India. Or it didn't matter who the person was who presented interesting new rock music. That's why you had to have payola. Because anybody could be a hit once they're on record, or on the radio, so you controlled it. You say, well, this guy's going to be the hit, not that guy. So, and remember, the internet collector's mentality is, you know, on the internet, you find all the stuff that was ignored by the mainstream media and declare those were better. Like there's this band I just heard about called The Monks, who showed up in a couple of music shows in the 60s and were a bit radical, and they're now sacred because they were different from the Beatles and the Stones or something. Look them up, The Monks, M-O-N-K-S, interesting guys. You ever heard of them?
No.
They're a bunch of guys from American soldiers who got a band together, and they appeared on TV a couple times, pretty avant-garde presenting of rock, or irritating form of rock, right in the middle of Top 40 radio. So anyways, so you have this David, what's his name, McCullough?
McGowan.
McGowan, looking back on icons. And he doesn't understand that Zappa and Jim Morrison and them were not icons. They did not change people. They were just passing, got their 15 minutes with many other guys. So to think the anthropomorphic chemical body image is influencing other chemical bodies is not what was controlling society. It was the mixed corporate media effect of the larger media environments where people had jet travel and go all over the place and never before, you know, had Western civilization to be able to interact with people all over the world and get interest in other cultures. It was a glorious time. There was no values. The Christian values were not destroyed or any other industrial values. They carried on. And government grew. Televangelism grew. Christianity grew. The Pope grew. Everybody grew in the information environment. They were all heading for an implosion that they didn't understand, but temporarily, I call it Baroque spirals of replays of historical institutions which had more wealth than ever before, including Wall Street. So you're saying that there's a conspiracy, you know, of linking Morrison to his father. His father suffered as much as Morrison did. Everybody suffered under the android meme. Families were ruined. The image of the family, the old family was gone. The churches, all these images were gone. They were all resuscitated in new ways in the cable TV era of the 80s, the Reagan era. America was reborn. Now where is it? It all happens, you know, so to think that, I mean, maybe Graham Parsons, you know, he knew somebody that got him a record deal and went through Paola. They might have used influence that way and got in there, but there was too much going on. Nobody controlled it. And Zappa himself says that. He understood that. He said, he could not be Frank Zappa, the Mother's Invention in the 80s or 90s. It was a totally different expanded information environment. Nobody didn't care about weirdness. It was only that weirdness became attractive to people in the bland hangover from the 50s, and music expressed it, and the kids got into it, and the record executives didn't know what was going on, so they didn't know what to sign, and Tom Wilson signed Zappa and didn't even know what he was signing. Got it all wrong. But anyways, the record got out, and Zappa's career started. You could not have created that counterculture or counter music, or whatever you want to call it, that renaissance of expression, unless you had the technological confusion that was going on. So now that's come and gone 100 times. You could say that Jim Morrison wiped out Christian culture, and then it got revived by Olivia Newton-John, and then it got wiped out by punk rock, and then it got revived by disco, and then it got wiped out by this. It just goes endless recycling. You see what I mean? Of memes. And actual people's lives are not Christian or pagan or any of these chemical body categories. They're discarded, quadriphenic, doing drugs, doing health food, eating bad food, screwing around everything, playing, liking, consuming different things, becoming a... One day they're a disc jockey, the next day they're bungee jumping, the next day they're homeless, and the next day they're a welfare bureaucrat, the next day they're working with Abby Hoffman, the next day they're helping Ron Paul get elected. You see what I'm saying? Look at the activities people do in 30. Just look at the baby boomers, how much of different variety of meme engagement they've done individually. They've been processing so many things that are archetypalized on my chart, all of the main meme quadrants everybody goes through. You follow what I'm saying? The turnover of media identities and media enthusiasms, the things that were threatened by that, Christianity or the Vatican, were long gone by World War II as an actual viable function. They only got revived by showing up on TV. And then TV collapsed with the internet. Then the internet collapsed with today. When will ION collapse? That's the deep question that Oprah Winfrey will explore tomorrow. But first we got to get ION on Oprah Winfrey.
On Oprah.
Yeah, and then we can collapse them a week later. And I think we'll end with that glorious scenario.